now.
101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. Welcome to WRIF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan. Peter and Jolene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Jolene.
Thank you very much. Welcome, everybody. I bet you, if you're listening regularly, you wonder, how come I always begin laughing? It's because Jolene and I have these great big smiles on our faces, because we're really happy to do this.
We love being here.
We love being
week,
here.
Week after week for all these years.
And, you know, we always say when we get like a weekend off, we say we're probably the only workers in the world that are saying, oh, no, wait a minute.
Please. Yeah. Don't give us the night off.
Don't give us the night off. Well, good health to you. Skol, yes. Salud, Shalom, or
all
I don't know, does that mean health? Yeah, everybody says to your health, and that's, I suspect, what this is going to be a lot about tonight, and that's the fact that the Affordable Care Act, known to its opponents at first as Obamacare, mm-hmm. but I don't think he cares that it's Obamacare.
No, he's like, go ahead, put
yeah.
my name on it,
yeah.
because this is going to be monumental.
Right, because... Well, the righties all are afraid that this is a slippery slope,
yeah.
and I'm hoping it is.
And what, well, explain that, but what we need to say is that the U.S. Supreme Court
sure.
Basically said
it's constitutional,
stays. Yes.
right, that the Affordable Care Act, which provides a great benefits to large numbers of the American people, is in fact constitutional. And Chief Justice John Roberts Jr., said that it's constitutional. He doesn't want to think it's the place of the court to comment on whether it's good policy or not. And that, that'll be, you know, we'll see. I mean, a lot of what's come into, what's been put in place already, the things that children can be on, parents, policies till they're 26, that children can't be refused because pre-existing conditions. Mm-hmm. There's
humane things like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, and of course the Republicans all oppose this.
Yes, because they have no hearts.
We asked
no
one
souls.
Of our Republican colleagues who has a child that needs to, who's like I think about 19 years old, that needs to stay on the parents' health care, and we said, so you know,
are you happy?
How are you going to vote? And he says, I'm thinking about it. You know.
Yeah. He really is thinking about yeah. it because, you know, it's easy to oppose something when it doesn't directly affect your personal life, especially when you're a fat cat politician who doesn't give one crap about anyone who may need that kind of health care. Well, everyone needs it and everyone deserves it.
Sure. And let's see. Oh, yeah. Actually, we rarely ever. Well, we didn't even do the basics, Jolene. It's
oh,
Night Call with Peter
Werby
and Jolene Jordan. Our phone number. And we'd like you to call in. What do you think about this decision?
And another question is, were you as shocked as I was personally? I really thought because it's
gonna
a conservative leaning 5-4 Supreme Court.
You would have thought
that for sure that it was. They never bend and go very rarely yeah. anyway. The way this goes.
The far right wing Chief Justice John Roberts Jr. joined the liberal minority.
Yeah.
The
yeah.
four other not really liberals, centrists on
True.
The Supreme Court. There are no liberals on the Supreme Court.
True.
So that's what shocked so many of the conservatives. But we'll get into that. If you'd like to join us, 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. I'm doing your job.
Do my job.
Yeah,
take it.
Yeah.
Why don't you?
yeah. Take this job and do it. Right. I'm curious if you have opinions of this, how you think this will affect you positively or negatively, and we rarely read emails right off the top, but I thought this was interesting. This was from Terry, and she wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Good evening, she said. Just wondering if there is somewhere I can go to get information about how Obamacare is going to affect people who are considered middle to low class and not
what?
Lower class or, you know, lower income class.
Yes.
Know. Yes. We're low class.
Well, yes. Yeah. We're down and dirty.
We're
though.
Down and dirty. She says, I'm a bit confused, but want to explain to my family that this is a good thing. My family, I'm the only liberal in a Republican family, are concerned that this is going to really hurt them. My sister barely can pay her bills and fears that now she'll be hurting more. She has no insurance with her job and is lucky to bring home $250 a week. She's a Republican?
But, yeah, and I'll never get that.
Yeah. So Terry asks, so how will she be able to afford to buy health care? I am trying to calm my family's fears and tell them this is going to be far better than not having health care. Just need help explaining this to them. By the way, thanks to my union job, I have excellent insurance. Thank you for your time. I love your show and would love to call in sometime to chat. She works the midnight shift. And she says, we do a great service. How much I learn from you every Sunday.
Thank you.
You can go, as I was just looking. Well, in fact, you can go to barackobama.com/health. BarackObama.com.
It's laid right out, everything right there.
Everything that is right out there. But, man.
And people are, a lot of people are worked up because, as usual, people don't have the correct information. They don't know. I think people are, in general, confused about what this is still and will be for a while because it is a little confusing. But the penalty that is what people are worried about if they don't get health insurance. It's $94 a year. It's not this big.
Or 1% of your income.
Of your pension. Yeah. Is what it said.
1% of your pension?
That's what it said.
What if you're...
whatever's higher.
What if you're 20 years old? What kind of pension?
So it's $94.
Oh, I
see. Get it?
I think it's... Well, all right. In some ways, this doesn't matter because this is going to play out, and we're going to see whether the people that proposed it have actually created a reform that this country so desperately needs. Because as we often say, we have the best medical care in the world, but we have one of the worst medical systems in the world, where tens of millions of people are uninsured. That they
people
estimate 44,000 people a year die because they don't have health insurance, and on like that. So one of the things, though, is that the conservatives, as always, are on the wrong side of everything. I mean, how do they have such an unbroken track record?
It really is amazing.
Yeah.
Their level of consistency is astounding.
And let's just, I mean, we don't want to go back, as we were talking last week, to the Revolutionary War when the conservatives sided with the British government and wanted us to remain as a colony. But just into the 1930s. Remember, they were against Social Security. They were against the minimum wage.
Yeah.
They were against the
child labor law.
They were against everything. And Social Security, they were against Social Security. That was going to break the country, and it was going to, you know, ruin everything and all that. And then, fast forward to the 1960s, they were against Medicare. You know, they were against the EPA, the Environmental Protection Act, everything.
Yeah.
They are so consistently wrong.
There's some civil rights issues in there.
Yeah, they were kind of bad. And some of those were Democrats,
women's
I know.
Women's rights, conservative. Maybe some women's rights.
Yeah, those were mostly Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
But they are just somewhere I saw that they said, Charles M. Blow in the Saturday New York Times. Republicans are apoplectic. They've lost again. The Supreme Court ruling.
They don't lose very often.
Yeah. There is a Supreme Court ruling on Thursday largely found President Obama's signature health care law to be constitutional and left them floundering and fuming.
Nice.
The conservative Chief Justice John Roberts Jr. joined the liberal wing of the court in doing so, much to the anger of the Republicans. Now, according to Mike Pence, a Indiana congressman and gubernatorial candidate, he said the Supreme Court's ruling upholding the Democratic health care law, he compared it to the September 11th terrorist attack.
Now, this is just, these guys are always reaching. They're completely insane.
They are, and you know what this is? This is really fascist hysteria. Now,
sure
here's
is.
What I mean. When the conservatives don't get their way, and this was particularly true in Europe in the 1920s and 1930s, when the conservatives don't get their way by dominating society through their corporations and the government, that's when they call in their fascist pals.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the symptoms of fascism, one of the ways you can sniff it out is the level of hysteria. Now, that dreadful woman, Sarah Palin, we can mention her name now because barely anyone else does.
She's not on the radar.
No, she tweeted, Obama lied, freedom died.
Oh, God.
Now, here's what's really interesting about that. She has twisted this anti-war sentiment.
Bush lied, people died.
Yeah, Bush lied, people
died. Used to be
died.
On my car.
Yeah, okay. But let's see. Senator Rand Paul, who sold out his daddy. Right?
Oh, yes, he did.
And endorsed George Romney. Issued a statement.
Otherwise known as Mitt Romney.
That seemed to suggest that the court doesn't even have the authority to make the ruling. Rand Paul's statement in part said, just because a couple of people on the Supreme Court declared something to be unconstitutional does not make it so. The whole thing remains unconstitutional. Dude!
Get a hold of yourself.
Let go of yourself.
Yeah, true.
Because that's it. You can say what you, we can all have an opinion about what is constitutional or not, but ultimately the Supreme Court is the arbiter of the law. So as it stands now, pardon me, it is. Constitutional.
But that doesn't mean in the future, depending on who controls Congress and who is in the presidency, that could change just like that. And the Supreme Court, of course, always.
Yeah. And the right wing went crazy. Again, fascist hysteria. The Judas Chief Justice, John Roberts, according to Charles M. Blow, the right wing personality, well, we never like to give his name, but his real name is Michael Weiner, suggested that Weiner, it is, suggested that Roberts ruled the way he did because of epilepsy medication. He said, neurologists will tell you that the medication used for seizure disorders, such as epilepsy, can introduce mental slowing, forgetfulness, and other cognitive problems. And if you look at Roberts' writing, you can see the cognitive disassociation, what he's saying.
Unreal. Now he's eating his own children.
So this is exactly, fascist hysteria. Now here, though. Here's, though, when it gets beyond, this is kind of going back to traditional conservative. A conservative radio show host, Neil Bortz, who is retiring and being replaced by 999. Why can't I ever remember his name?
Why do we do this?
We have a block.
But I thought of it last week.
Big Hat.
Now you did it to me again.
Yeah.
I'll think of it. Herman Cain.
Herman Cain. Damn. Yeah, 999. N-E-I-N-E-I-N-E-I-N.
Yeah, no
which is
doubt.
Not my misspelling, but
fascist.
no in German. He said, tweeted following the ruling. Now, you got to get this, folks. This is Republican. This is a conservative. This is the party of which so many people that have no business voting for vote for. Here's what he said. He's a spokesman for the Republican Party. I am so sick to death of calling the play-by-play of the destruction of this great country by power-hungry Democrats. That's okay. He can say that. I mean, I don't see where this gives Democrats
any more.
But let me start it again. I am so sick to death of calling the play-by-play of the destruction of this great country by power-hungry Democrats and the moocher class.
And what is he saying?
I am so close to saying F-bombs.
Yeah, but don't do it.
That horrid effing man.
Yeah, horrid effing man. And, he's basically, once again, like all of these other cats, sweeping poverty aside and saying that they are not... They're worse people, that they're not good people because they're poor. And who cares about them? Just let them stay in their ghettos. Let them stay in their,
rural poverty in there.
Right,
yeah, yeah.
Right.
And this is happening in Pennsylvania because of the Republican governor, that 89,000 children in Pennsylvania have lost to Medicaid. Maybe you've got this real hatred for those poor people that are taking, Medicaid and all that. But what about their kids?
That they're sucking off the teat of this country. That's what they say. And that's just so vile. They have no hearts whatsoever.
Here's the moocher class, a 5-year-old with leukemia, a 2-year-old with a congenital heart disorder, a severely disabled 12-year-old who requires home health care, 9-year-old twins, one with autism, the other with a hearing impairment, a 1-year-old with cerebral palsy.
Yeah.
I mean, these people have no heart.
Zero.
And if you vote for them, you have no head.
Yeah, or heart. You're cold, too.
Yeah.
You're cold, too.
But, let's look at the moocher class. According to these right-wing Republicans.
We would never say that.
Yeah, no, we would never say that. Because, the people that are now getting socialized medicine, that is, the government is a single payer. Well, it's our grandparents, right? Tens of millions of people over 65.
Right.
Medicare, okay. The poor and the disabled also get it. That's according to the Republicans, the moocher class.
Uh-huh.
How about this big moocher class? Veterans
who
get universal single care, single payer health care courtesy of the government. And even small group prisoners, So they could, maybe
just let them rot in there.
Yeah, but if you take the people on Medicare, our seniors, our elders, the people on Medicaid, and the veterans, and I'll add the prisoners. I mean, you've got a substantial proportion of our society that's already getting government health care.
Yes,
single
absolutely.
Payer universal health care.
And even better, health care than what this current health care plan, otherwise known as Obamacare, is than that plan is, because it's not as good. We want the single payer in this country, but that's not where the law stands.
By the way, I will a little later read that the left is very critical, both of Obamacare, well, not the decision upholding it, but still says, as you're indicating, Jalene, that it's just not adequate. There's still like 28 million people that aren't going to have health care in this country. And, well, you know, we never really answered Terry's email about her sister who takes home $250.
Yeah.
She's going to get free, she's eligible for free health care. Beginning in 2014.
Hallelujah.
Yeah, and it should have been begun in 2010. It should have begun in 1948. And, oh, by the way, this socialism, socialized medicine. Mm. Now, what group of commies first put this forth? Let me see if I've got the info. Oh.
Tell me, Peter.
1983, it was the Heritage Society, which is a far right-wing think tank.
Yeah.
And why? Because they were trying to head off universal single-payer health care. They thought, wait a minute, we want this still privatized. We still want big insurance companies and big pharma involved in this. We want our buddies, the big corporate rich people, to continue to make their profits.
Yeah. So and stick it up the you-know-what.
We're
going to
get that in. And I'm trying to think. Here. Wait a minute. Here, in fact, it is. Nancy Altman, co-chair of the Strengthen Social Security campaign, she said, the individual mandate, and that means where every single one of us is required to have health insurance and you have to buy it. And it's going to be through these exchanges. And I don't know if you really want to get into what that all means, but each state has to set it up.
Yeah.
The Republicans are already waffling here in Michigan, which means we're going to lose about $10 million, you know.
Yeah.
And the feds will come in and then set it up. And you can make between a you're eligible for a subsidy if you make between 133% and 400% of the poverty level income. And I mean,
you get a subsidy for making money?
You know what?
That's strange.
I was going to say this eventually. I mean, this is pretty disjointed. And it's because a lot of this is clear as mud. Let's say that everything that the non-hysterical conservatives and the insane fascists, forgetting about them, but the criticism, because they say it's a job killer. I mean, the Congressional Budget Office says it'll actually.
You said that like George Bush.
Pay for itself and even create jobs. But okay, let's say, so it'll kill jobs. It will, stop small businesses from hiring. It will take away freedom of choice of doctors and I forgot some other stuff like that. They got
their little list.
Okay. Let's, you know, worst case scenario.
Let's say.
The critics, the Republicans, the conservatives were all right.
Okay.
Wow. So this law turns out to be awful. So we repeal it.
So you change it.
You change it.
You change it to what it ultimately needs to be, single payer.
But remember I was saying earlier about this fascist hysteria. The former spokesman for the Michigan Republican Party, Matthew Davis, who was actually a scab, that's a union term for someone who breaks a strike, who goes back to work when his union is on strike, when he worked at the Detroit News during the great newspaper strike between 1995 and 2000, he immediately broke the strike. I mean, these folks have no sense of solidarity, whatever. Anyways, he wrote, he sent out this email, said, "Is armed rebellion now justified?" He said, here's my response, and yes, I mean it. There are times government has to do things to get what it wants and holds a gun to your head. I'm saying at some point we have to ask the question, when do we turn that gun around and say no and resist? You can't have people walking around with lattes and signs and think the object of your opposition is going to take you seriously. Armed rebellion is the end point of that physical confrontation.
This guy is a joke, and it's another example of these dangerous words. It reminds me, was he at the Ted Nugent concert the other night?
We were.
Swear to God,
yeah. We didn't stay for it.
We didn't stay, folks. Don't worry. Don't worry.
But this is fascist hysteria. I mean, to talk about instituting a law that could conceivably be bad. I mean, it looks like it's going to be better than what we've had, to my point of view.
Yeah, well, for example, for me, it's better than what I have because...
You have zero.
I have nothing.
And you will now...
I'm waiting.
Yeah.
I'm ready.
Bring it. Yeah, why didn't it start 4 years ago?
I paid for all my
ago?
Stuff out of my pocket, you know?
Tired of it. Yeah, so, but that's fascist hysteria. To say, you know, to shake your head and to say, well, like, for instance, the Citizens United decision where the Supreme Court, the conservatives, said that money is speech and billionaires can pump as much money into electoral campaigns as they can possibly do. So the point where they're going to probably have $1 billion pumped into Romney's campaign.
My God.
Hoping he's going to, you know, give them a little more free rein than they already have, which is pretty free rein.
If he gets in, it's all based on money and lies.
No, there you go.
Yeah.
Yeah. But somehow that just cleared my brain
it
from
did.
What it had.
Because
that's
it
okay.
Was, because it was so brilliant?
Yes, it was.
Thank you.
It was. What was I saying? Essentially what I was saying was Citizens United. That was a terrible decision. It has so distorted our electoral process, indeed. It was the absolute worst thing that could have happened to a democracy, and that's the way I feel. And I'm going to say, okay, time for armed rebellion.
I mean, whatever. These people, it was like, just grab your cojones and spit on the ground while you're at it.
Because you can scratch a right-wing conservative, because, you know, there's moderate conservative, David Brooks of the New York Times, and then there's...
Wait a minute. Who else?
But you scratch a right-wing conservative, and pretty soon you'll find a fascist. And all you got to do is look at the history of Europe, you know, Spain, Germany, Italy, Romania, Poland, those other countries that went fascist. And it was, and they had a level of hysteria that life was going to be so altered by some liberal program that did something in nothing like what's happening here. Give a few people more some health care.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they want to shoot.
The right thing to do.
And they want to shoot to kill. Let me just quickly.
Because we do have some people waiting.
Yeah, we do. A bunch of these folks from, where is this, profs at the Harvard Medical School and co-founders of Physicians for a National Health Program, which means a full government. You know what that would mean? Would be you would take the Medicare Act and just subtract two words, over 65.
Yeah.
So it's Medicare for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, there's very few people other than these nutball right-wing libertarian, you know, conservatives and all that, they want to get rid of Medicare. So, and usually, I mean, I would say, would you object to lowering it to 64? You know, how about that? You know, well, it's not so terrible. What about 54, 44?
Yeah.
So it would be the same thing. And are there problems with Medicare? Yeah. Are there problems with other national health programs throughout the world?
Yeah.
I mean, they're bureaucracies. Usually the countries are wasting too much money on the military. Like our country.
Absolutely. Yeah. When 50%, you're worried about your tax dollars. I mean, I know I say this a lot, but 50% at least of your tax dollars are going to the military industrial complex to fight these wars. Most of them that were started for no reason or under the basis of lies.
Mm. Anyway, they say, these folks from the Physicians for a National Health Program, although the Supreme Court has upheld the Affordable Care Act, the unfortunate reality is the law, despite its modest benefits, is not a remedy to our health care crisis. So there are modest benefits, they say. It will not achieve universal coverage as it leaves at least 26 million uninsured. These Republican governors are saying they're just not going to even take up the Medicaid benefits. It will not make health care affordable to Americans with insurance because these costs just keep rising.
Yeah.
This is nothing
and that
to
has nothing to do with the law.
Nothing to do with the law,
it's all
right.
All the insurance companies, pharmaceutical companies.
Yeah, and because of high copays and gaps in coverage that leave patients vulnerable to financial ruin in the event of serious illness, and it will not control costs. Let's see, I thought I had one more. This is what I said earlier. The individual mandate, the focus of the right-wing attack, this taking away our freedom. You know, to drive in this state, and I probably all the others, you have to have insurance. You can't say, you know, the state can't force me to have insurance, I'll just take my chances. You know, because you know what? The costs get socialized. Because when you get in an accident and you don't have insurance and there turns out to be hundreds of thousands of dollars of damages in medical
care.
Yeah,
who eats it?
We eat it. So that's why to keep the costs down to what they are, you know, I'm not trying to sell either health insurance or car insurance as being some great bargain. But if it wasn't required, it would be even worse. So there has to be the individual mandate. So as I said earlier, what commies suggested this? Well, it turns out to be originally proposed by the very conservative Heritage Foundation, not in 1983, as I said, but 1989. It was introduced into Congress by the late Republican Senator John Chafee, Republican of Rhode Island, in 1993. And that was to head off Hillary's idea to have a much more expansive care.
You know, there was something funny going around on Facebook about Obama saying, you know, we passed Obamacare, you know, that it's been called constitutional, blah, blah, blah. And she said, yeah, thanks for finishing what I started. And I remembered that back when she was doing that, when I was a television news reporter, and I interviewed her all about this health care thing. I mean, I just remember it like it was yesterday. Mm. So it's cool to see that it's gone somewhere.
Well, this Obamacare was originally a Republican bill, and such conservative co-sponsors as Orrin Hatch, a Republican of Utah, and your senator at the time, Charles Grassley, a Republican of Iowa.
Yeah, where I'm from.
Where it's very
sorry,
hot.
People.
Yeah. So what's
gay marriage there? Leave Iowa alone.
So what's really happened is this very, very conservative free enterprise healthcare system has been put into force. And that was the best that Obama could do. And when I said earlier at the beginning, you said I didn't explain that he said this was a slippery slope. I hope it is a slippery slope that finally includes everybody in a Medicare for All program, which would be just like our seniors have, just like our veterans have.
Right.
Okay?
I
don't understand the objection to that.
Let's take care of our people, because then we're going to be a healthier nation. And overall, it will change. It'll change so many things on so many levels.
Yeah. By the way, I want to get you on the air. This one's too long, but I'll just read the headline. Oregon study shows benefits and price for newly insured. Oh, it doesn't say. It's just talking about all these people that in this lottery, they had to have a lottery in Oregon to see who got to have like Medicare like care.
Yeah.
And
before any of this.
Yeah. It says,
why? Because they're broke?
Tens of thousands of Oregonians had found that gaining insurance makes people feel healthier, happier, and more financially stable.
Well,
you know why? Because you're not if you don't have it.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Let's do this. Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan is who you're listening to. Night Call is the show. Our number is 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
You can email us at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. And Athena, I saw answering the phone. Sarah is with us. Yes or no?
I don't think I saw Athena in there. I'm not sure. Sorry if you're in there, Sarah. Hey.
Yeah.
I usually try to check in before the show.
No. Just Athena's there. You can reach her at that number. You can also go to our Facebook page and leave comments, facebook.com/nightcall.
Please do.
And Athena will have a podcast.
And check this out. Got an email, and the subject line is Supreme Court decision, a Republican conspiracy. Remember when you said that?
Yeah.
Something about that?
Well, there is
you
something.
You didn't use that word, though.
In the Weekly Standard, this boring conservative paper, it says, this election just became about Obamacare. And that could be what John Roberts wanted.
Yeah,
because they've worked up a lot of people that this is socialism and that it should be, but it's not. And one of the things that all this was that Chief Justice Roberts, he wanted to maintain the integrity of the court. He wants Obama to lose very, very, very badly because he wants he wants when these older centrist and liberal so-called justices retire.
Mm-hmm. He wants to fill that court with his people.
Yeah, some more right-wing Catholics.
Yeah, scary.
All right.
I may be out of here at that point. I keep saying that.
Yeah. You know what? You're going to have to forgive me, folks. In fact, I'm going to call you by name, so you got to stay with me,
Peter.
Because we've got to do these commercials first. But Louie from St. Clair Shores, Michael from Fenton, Ken from New Hudson, Scooter from Taylor.
And you.
And you. That means there's, two more lines open, and we'll give you it right now. You guys stay with us. We'll get you on the air thing right after these.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jalene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this. This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome back. We're talking about the fact that the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, has been upheld as constitutional. All of its benefits that the majority of American people support, like the fact preconditioned are not insurance companies.
Pre-existing conditions.
Thank you.
Yeah. You can. They're not going to knock you out for that. And we're talking by the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yeah. Paul Krugman in the New York Times says there will be no doubt be many headlines declaring this a big victory for President Obama, which it is, but the real winners are ordinary Americans, people like you. What do you think? He says, how many people are we talking about?
Yeah. Subject. It's unreal. People, it's really, you're one way or the other on this thing. Yeah. Or you're just plain freaking confused.
Well, I was going to say there's a lot of confusion. Yeah. Paul Krugman says, how many people are we talking about? You might say 30 million, the number of additional people the Congressional Budget Office says will have health insurance thanks to Obamacare. But that vastly understates the true number of winners because millions of other Americans, including many who oppose the act, would have been at risk of being one of those 30 million. So add in every American who currently works for a company that offers good health insurance but is at risk of losing that job, and who isn't in this world of outsourcing and private equity buyouts. Every American who would have found health insurance unaffordable will now receive a crucial financial help. And that's what you got to understand, that if you make between, and I can't go on, like you said, I wasn't being clear, 133% to 400% of the poverty level.
For a family of four?
Depends on whether you're single or have,
okay.
You will be eligible for government subsidies. Every American with pre-existing condition who would have been flatly denied coverage, and the Affordable Care Act is fully paid for with an explicit combination of tax increases to the wealthy, not to the middle class, not to the working class, not to the poor, but also spending cuts. So your thoughts, 313-298-WRIF. Let's get our first caller. It's Louie in St. Clair Shores. Louie, hi. It's Peter and Jalene. You're on the air. What do you think?
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
I think there's a couple of things that I'm concerned about with it. I do like the fact that your child can stay on it longer.
Till 26.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
It is.
But what concerns me is this insurance going to have major gaps in it where people aren't insured on, things that a normal Blue Cross, Blue Shield plan may have, or a HAP plan?
I think you're insured on the same things.
I was going to go a different way. Really? I was going to probably, going to have a little recording tonight that I'm going to play that just keeps saying, I don't know. because it's not clear. And that's what I was saying earlier. We've got to really wait and see whether this works well or not. Nothing is written in stone. I mean, because here we got George Romney says, day one, he's going to have a busy day. I'm repealing
George
this
Romney,
sucker.
George.
Did I say George?
Yeah,
okay.
Second time tonight.
What's his son's name? Mitt.
Mitt.
Yeah. Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney.
Here
wait,
for
what?
You.
So why did you
here
tell me the
you,
first
baby.
Time?
I did. You didn't hear me.
Oh, okay.
You're ignoring me over here.
So Mitt Romney, well, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
That's okay. Another thing that concerns me.
Well, wait a minute. Well, let me finish then.
Yeah.
Mitt Romney says, I'm going to repeal this immediately. So it's repealable. And if the other way around, say that Obama gets reelected and we say, wow, this little part of it really sucks. And it does, there is a gap. So you fill in the gap. So, but there's nothing. I mean, these people that are going over the edge about it, like somehow that, communism was just declared is kind of insane. But go ahead, Louis.
Okay, two more things that concern me about
it. Oh, two?
One,
okay.
is, so someone has insurance at their company, and they say, okay, well, I'm paying all this money for my insurance. Maybe I'll just drop my insurance when enrollment period comes, and I'll just won't have insurance. I'll pay the penalty, and it'll cost me less to pay the penalty than it would to either drop my insurance or even take my insurance from my company when it becomes available to me.
Huh? I hear you. I don't know. Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, whether that's...
As Peter said, he does not know.
I mean, it's partly...
I don't think anyone knows. It's got to shake out, just like the medical marijuana laws
Michigan. You don't want to wind up with... You don't want to wind up, usually, with no insurance. I mean, that's
right.
That's kind of a bad deal. But some people...
be on this plan, though.
See? Some people have said that businesses are going to say, well, hey, why don't we just drop all our...
Yeah, go get your own.
Yeah, go get your own through the...
There has to be some kind of regulation of
these exchanges. But so far, companies haven't been threatening to do that. And got a lot of calls, Louis. So okay, one more quick.
Yeah, sure. The other one is, you know, we're moving, that's kind of now towards socialized medicine. Now, Canada has this.
Yeah.
And they're really.
Wait, what?
Oh, yeah.
What? Go ahead.
Canada has socialized medicine.
Yeah.
And they don't have enough doctors because the doctors aren't paid enough to get into that field.
Well, okay. I don't know. Here's what I always say about Canada. Oftentimes, well, then you're talking about triaging, which would mean that usually what happens in most countries that where there's not some attempt at equity is that the poor are the ones that lose out. So what you have is that, you know, under a market system is those of us that can afford it, we get it, you know, because we can pay for it. If Canada does not have enough money to, and I've said this any number of times, sometimes the Canadians go nuts, Canada doesn't need a military. It certainly doesn't need battleships to be, which they're going to start buying under this nutball Stephen Harper, the prime minister, to patrol the now ice-free Arctic and all that. They should just have like Costa Rica, just sort of a police force enough to deal with crime and what have you, and spend the billions of dollars that they're wasting on a military. And as I always say, the only country that is ever going to invade Canada in the foreseeable future is called the United States of America. So, and they can't do anything to stop that. So they ought to take all of that money and put it in more into services for their people.
Yeah.
But those are all good points.
At least they have a system, and so does every other industrialized country in the world.
Yeah, and there's never, I got to say, there's never, whenever there's a bureaucracy that's either governmental or private. I mean, certainly every one of us who has private health insurance will go on a bitch fest forever about any one of the plans we have and how much paperwork. And I can't believe
it. I hear a lot of people bitching about it. I wouldn't know.
Yeah. So,
the luxury that you have called health insurance.
All right. Thanks, Louie. Those are good points. Let's see. Here is Michael in Fenton. Michael, hi. You're on the air. Welcome.
Well, I tell you, I'm happy for Obama and the American people to get the health care. That's something that the Republicans would never want to happen. They're just, you know, Republicans are, you know, perfect. What I think is disjointed says it all for them. I got a couple things I'd like to say about the health care. If we can get health care for $94 a month, 300 million people, that's $28.2 billion.
Wait.
The number that I threw out was the penalty.
Yeah.
They decided it was a tax.
It's a
tax. If you don't get it, then you'll pay per year. The number that I read was $94.
Right. Or 1%.
I'm going to have to pay $1,000. They're going to throw me in jail and, you know, tie me up and never let me out. Throw away the key.
I just heard Jeff Feiger on television. He said there's no way to enforce it. There's no mechanism within the Obamacare law that would adjudicate that. I mean, I suppose what they can do is if some way or other, I don't know how you would indicate to the IRS that you don't have health care.
Right.
And then they would assess you on your taxes.
You know,
another
I'll tell you how they can do that, Peter. Oh. You know, what they can do is they can just include on that microchip that people are saying that they're going to implant in us because they're going to take over and then we're going to all become, you know, robots.
Yeah.
Just put all the information in the microchip.
Yeah.
You know what?
Here's what I think, Michael. You know, one of the things, if we recorded all of what we're talking about now, I don't know if you ever work at a company where suddenly they bring in all these new procedures
after meetings,
and everybody, like, we had a new healthcare system here. For those of us that have it, as I have to keep saying, and and everybody is saying, "What's going on? What if I did it?" But I don't understand. Who pays for this? Is it the company or no? Do I have to add to it? But I thought it was like that. Well, now it's just commonplace. So
yeah,
if we recorded the show,
we do record the show.
Yeah,
podcast will be available tomorrow at noon.
Right, and 2 years from now, when in 2014, when this goes into full swing, when Obamacare goes into full swing, people are going, wow, man, can you believe these Republicans were saying this was like 9/11 and that we ought to have armed rebellion?
Yeah.
Because it'll just become part of the wallpaper. Because you remember what
part
I said,
life.
The conservatives and the right wingers went crazy when Roosevelt wanted to put in a minimum wage.
My God, can you imagine?
That's
going to
destroy America.
Yeah.
All right, Michael, thank you. Appreciate it.
And that thing needs to be at least doubled.
There you go. Go crazy. Here's Ken in New Hudson. Ken, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, how's it going?
Going good.
First off, Mountain Dew or Monster?
Mountain Dew.
Oh.
Mountain Dew, all right.
Okay, what else? What else you got for me? Come on.
All right, honestly, I have to, I can't say I'm right or left wing, but I don't think that Obamacare will work. As in...
Why?
The way I think it should be is if you tax less, the people will have more money, okay? And then the people can sustain themselves, bring up the lower class. Each class will bring up the class below it with less taxes. More things will be affordable, and things can cost less.
So are you saying that we need to make sure that the wealthy continue to have these insane tax cuts while that the middle class is shrinking and while the poor are getting poorer and the working class is getting poorer? And
yeah, you got to remember the wealthy, they sent all our jobs overseas. And they were the ones like Romney with his Bain equity.
Bain Capital.
Bain Capital, you know, just kind of looted these companies and made millions. But you know, the taxes, I don't, you know, people I can't keep up. People can't keep up with costs because there's if you completely eliminated my taxes and suddenly I got some virulent cancer, I wouldn't have enough money to pay for that. I wouldn't have enough. And you know what happens now, Ken, without that, I could reach a certain limit and they'd say, sorry, you're out of here, dude. Or, or Jolene, could say, all right, now I'm going to go get, I've got a tax cut. I'm going to go get some health insurance. And then she didn't realize she has a pre-existing condition.
Let's
and
not
they can
say that.
And they can say, sorry, right?
Not
do you have health insurance? Do you have health insurance?
Yes, I do.
Okay. How
is it?
It's pretty good.
I mean,
it's
through your job or your parents or?
It's through my job.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
But, I mean, on the flip side of that is the reason I think it's gotten to this point is because we've depended on the government for a little too much, whereas.
Like what? Like who?
It's gotten a little out of hand. Like, okay, pretty soon we want them to run our education and then our health care.
Wait.
Pretty soon
they
do run our education, and it's crappy at that, and they need to put a hell of a lot more money into it.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
Yeah, we definitely need more in the education system, but I was homeschooled, and, like, okay.
Well, you can't ever, all right, but you know what?
Parents have to go
I gotta
to work.
Tell you,
make money.
I gotta tell you, Ken, you flunk.
Ken.
See you later, Ken. Yeah, right. He went home school. Damn. Scooter and Taylor. Hi, Scooter. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Scooter.
Yeah, I got a few things to tell you. The first thing is...
Oh, God.
Now, I know, I just heard you say something about our schools not doing well. We need to put more money into it.
Yeah, it's a very sad state of affairs.
If you're so smart, where are you going to get the money from?
Where are you going to get the money? The government. How about I'll tell you exactly. Peter, turn him down, please. I'll tell you exactly where we're going to get the money there, Scooter. We're going to get it from cutting the war budget, the defense budget, at least in half. How about we cut it by, I don't know, what do you say, Peter, 80%? And guess what? There you go. Boom. There's your money. Answer.
Yeah.
Got
well,
any
let
more
me
questions?
Tell you something. Do you know that we're in debt with China for $26 billion?
Well, you know, the reason that we are is a whole lot of reasons that ought not to be. So, I mean, Scooter, you're asking these questions. So what's your opinion? What do you think we ought to do or not do?
Or we just let people rot in hell die?
Wait.
Go. Hey, tell her to chill, man.
No, I'll never tell. I might tell you to chill, but I'm not going to tell her to chill.
She knows better than
to
tell me, Dill.
Wait.
Scooter. Wait. Hold on. Go ahead. You got the floor.
First off, Scooter.
All right.
Angry.
Everybody needs health care. There's no doubt on that.
Okay.
We all do.
Okay,
right.
We agree.
I agree with that.
Great.
But tell me how many people are in the United States?
300 and some million.
Yeah.
Okay, let's say we spend $1 a day on each one of these people.
Yeah.
All right, for health care. Now, tell me, where are we getting that money from?
Well, I hate to do what I just told you not to do, but I will answer your question with a question. if we can't afford it, how do we decide who, I mean, it's the triage, right? It's the them that got that continues to get and screw the hindmost, right?
No, that's not what I'm saying.
All right.
You don't understand that this country is so far in debt, we need to work towards getting out of debt, and then the economy will go up. Now, I know that people have to suffer at times like this, and I understand that, and they shouldn't have to.
Right.
But, and I agree that we spend way too much on the military.
Thank you.
I mean, we fight for wars that shouldn't even be over there.
Well, you're just turning around, Scooter. I feel like you and I could come together and hug.
I'm right on that.
I think we could be friends again.
Hey, look overseas. We went over in Iraq. Now, Hussein was a maniac. We went in there and we did it. All right? We did it. We should get out. Not spend around there for two.
Yeah, well, you know, things are really, now they have malls there and McDonald's.
Starbucks, they got movie theaters, bring it.
All right, I got you, Scooter. Well,
Scooter.
Here's one of the things. I mean, everything is allocated in a bad way. I mean, I don't want to use the same icky example. But what we need is a lot of healthcare practitioners. We don't just need doctors. I mean, if
physician's assistants.
Yeah, if you got, you know, boo-boos or whatever, you don't have to go to a doctor. And, you know, because you get a cut. Right now, even I have health care, and if I got this, I don't know. Can you see that scar
on
my arm?
What?
It's a scar.
You're always showing me your physical ailments and telling me all weird stuff.
Now, what do you think that sounds like to people?
Where'd you get that scar?
And it doesn't matter. But I cut my arm. I had to go.
Tell me everything else.
I had to go to the. I had to go to the emergency room, and I forgot. So I can't even begin to guess what this all costs. But and it cost me $100. Under my insurance now, yeah.
So it would have been about $500 or something.
Yeah,
maybe.
So that's ridiculous for a cut on my arm.
I would have sewed myself up for that.
So there's got to be a way we got to get a handle on these healthcare costs, for sure.
Yep.
But Scooter, thank you. I appreciate your call.
Yeah.
Here's Brian. Brian's in Bloomfield. Hey, Brian, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hey guys, how are you?
We're good.
You're great. How are you?
Good. I'm working on a documentary right now, and I just called in because I'm actually working on a documentary called Bitter Pill.
Huh.
And it's with a neurosurgeon, and he's been working on this for 4 years, traveled around the world, and he's very passionate about this. We're hoping to release it in August, but the thing about it is that working on this documentary has really educated me to the system, and when I hear you talking about spending money, mm-hmm. we need to spend more money in these things, a statistic that jumped out at me was the money we spend on healthcare with the country, it would be the sixth largest economy in the world.
Yeah.
That's how much money a year we spend on healthcare. The problem isn't how much money we spend. The problem is how much things cost here, because at every single level of healthcare, this price is jacked because that's the way the system works.
That's right.
So from the bottom up, it only makes sense because it's all profit driven for everybody to tack on amount money one after another. By the time it gets to the insurance companies, it's astronomical.
Sure.
And these are things that are burying us as a country. We can't sustain it. We don't have a choice anymore.
So is that the premise of the documentary?
It's one of the premises. It really is talking about the entire system the way it is.
Around the world?
Yeah, he also compares it to other systems around the world, talks to other people around the world, and it's interesting too because being able to work on this, to a person, everywhere he's gone, from Sweden to France to the UK, everywhere he's gone, when he's asked somebody, man on the street, what do you think of your health care? Every one of them says it's great, love it.
Yep.
Everyone that he has ever asked here that we have on camera, every single person says it's the worst.
Yeah.
It's awful.
It's the best, but it's the worst. Like we always say, and like we said at the beginning of the show, or Peter said, we have the best health care, just the worst health care system. And when is this going to be out?
Brian, let me ask you this, too. How does it compare, to Michael Moore's documentary Sicko, which in some ways started this whole debate a few years ago?
You know what? He did a great job talking about the health care insurance companies, the health insurance companies, but he really kind of made them the bad guys and really This film, it talks more about the bigger picture, everything that the callers tonight have even called and talked about, the wars, the other things that have really escalated everything to the point of where it's at today.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not necessarily a film about who's, you know, a bad guy in just one arena. It's across the board. And it really kind of talks about a philosophical difference. There was a pediatrician in France.
We're up against a clock. Can we do this? For one thing, is there a website for it yet?
Yeah, it's actually going to be up at the end of this month. It's called bitterpilldoc.com.
Okay, well, email us and keep us
informed. All right, but listen, you know, it's kind of thing that I also do interviews that go at the end of this. So you can email me at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. I'd like to do more. I'd like to talk more, but I got to go. So thank you very much. And we got an insurance agent waiting and some more. Let's see. Gary in Rochester, Luke in Monroe. Jim's down in Toledo and over in Windsor making our show international as Eric. So we want to get.
Peter, go.
Okay.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan. On 101 WRIF, let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julene will be taking more of your calls right after this. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julene.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back to our
third
segment, as I was trying to sort through that. At 1 a.m., a couple of interesting interviews, which I'll try to remember what they are as this hour goes on. Hey, join us on Facebook.
I can tell you what they are.
Oh, you know?
If you like.
Yeah, go ahead.
I do know.
Okay.
Even though you did the interviews, I know.
Right, go ahead.
Prudence L. Carter, author of Stubborn Roots, Race, Culture, and Inequality in U.S. and South African Schools.
That was interesting,
And Ken Waxberger, editor of Insider Histories of the Vietnam Era Underground Press. I love that.
Yeah.
I love them both.
Great book. Has a great quote on the back.
Yeah?
From me.
Oh, that's right. I saw that.
Yeah. But join us on Facebook, facebook.com/nightcall. You can email us at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Athena is taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF, and she's going to post a podcast in just about 12 hours or so. One of the things that sort of right-wing hysteria has been going on about, if the IRS is going to show up at your door.
We're talking about health care.
Yeah, the health care deal. And if you don't, submit to this individual mandate, you're going to be, your property is going to be confiscated and all that. And Stephen from Farmington Hills writes, what if you don't pay your fine if you don't buy insurance? It seems you don't have much to worry about, despite Fox News telling people the government will get the IRS after you and place a lien, L-I-E-N, on your property.
These people ought to be arrested.
Yeah, they are. Well, have you seen some of the,
crimes against humanity.
Yeah, I mean, they were saying that the health care law excludes Muslims from it.
Unbelievable,
yeah.
Quit lying. Quit making.
On page 336 of the Senate's Affordable Health Care Act, it states, there's a lot of bugs in here.
What the hell?
Yeah. It says, in the case of any failure by a taxpayer to timely pay any penalty imposed by this section of the Affordable Care Act, such taxpayer shall not be subject to any criminal prosecution or penalty with respect to such failure.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you...
Where do they get this?
Yeah.
They look at that, and they'll read that, and they'll go, okay, now just take that and totally turn it upside down and make a big lie up and get it to me in 5 minutes. Thanks.
On the same page, it says the Health and Human Services Secretary shall not file notice of lien with respect to any property of a taxpayer by reason of any failure to pay the penalty or levy on such property with respect to such failures.
Next thing you know, they're going to say that they'll take your guns. If you don't get national
Someone
healthcare.
Said something about it. Here's Brian in Shelby Township. He's an insurance agent.
Click.
What? Click? I didn't click?
Mm-mm.
All right. Let's try it one more time.
There
Hi, Brian. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, Peter. How are you, Janine?
Hi.
I don't even know where to start. It'd probably be a good dialogue. No doubt you're right about the hysteria, but there's hysteria and there's
confusion
on both sides of the aisle, as there always is. But I'm an agent. I make it my business to know what's going on. And quite frankly, I'm not a fan of insurance companies. I got in the business for a very interesting reason that I won't go into, but it was because I was scammed. Mm-hmm. Ad by a bad agent, a bad insurance company.
Really?
So, yeah, absolutely. And that's why I was a builder, and I got into the business for that reason. And it cost me a lot of money, and I got pretty bent out of shape about it. So I went into the business to help people navigate, to help people know what they have, good, bad, or ugly. And I think the first, there are some things that are in place right now that are really good. I mean, no doubt. Children are guaranteed insurable. No doubt. That's a must. You get preventative care right now that's included with major medical plans. That's not every medical plan. That's major. And that's the only thing that we'll call it Obamacare, because that's what everybody relates to it as. That's the only thing that people really, don't understand, is there are certain health plans that fall under these guys. There are a lot of other ones that don't fall under it. But anyway, as far as major goes, preventative health care is included. If you have a major plan, you can go get a physical mammogram, pap smear once a year, no charge, okay, yep. As long as it's preventive. That's an excellent thing. The 80-20 medical loss ratio gets a little bit confusing, and I won't muddy up the waters, but what it does is it basically limits how much insurance companies can raise high rates or lower rates in any given year. I should say it forces them to lower rates or rebate money if they spend more or less than 80% of their gross on claims. And for the first time in history, this year, some of the most major players in the health insurance industry are actually rebating money to their policyholders. And I haven't seen that on a single news story anywhere.
Let me just interrupt you one second, Brian. And sure. One of the things that some of the conservatives fear is that this limit on profit is this is what they are, one of the things they're concerned about. But go ahead.
Well, and you know what? I'm more conservative, and when it comes to a private business being told how much they can or can't make by the government, I am 100% against that.
But the only thing, I mean, we talk about controlling costs, and we at some point, I mean, we've got to draw some lines, or this will just, it is out of control now, and it's going to get worse.
Right, and for the policyholder, it's a great thing.
Yeah.
For the business, it's not a great thing. And for the policyholder, there's no doubt, because that's one of the biggest complaints is, you know, I looked at my bill and it went up 48%, it went up 60% or so forth. The other side of that is like your average dollar store needs about 27% of their gross to break even, just to keep the lights on. Well, in the insurance industry, they're keeping it at 20%. Government says it has to be 20%. So first thing they did was destroy the agents. I mean, I make pennies. I really do. And it's, I'm not getting rich off anything as far as health insurance goes, that's for sure. But anyway, so you're looking at everything, I think the biggest misconception is everybody's going to get this free health care, or everybody's going to be covered. The problem is with that, the way it intertwines with the 80-20 medical loss ratio, if you instantly open the floodgates and you insure everybody that comes through the door, which morally is what should happen.
Okay.
As a business goes, if you do that, your costs skyrocket. Now you've got an 80-20 medical loss ratio in there that says that you can't raise rates unless they're justified.
Yeah, but the insurance companies went along with it because they're getting so many more customers that they figured this will be a wash in terms of payouts and what it's going to...
I got to interrupt you there, because my $500 a month family plan is going to justifiably, according to the law, spike, and I mean, this is, I'm not pulling these numbers out of thin air. It's going to go up triple. By the end of 2014, I'm going to be paying $1,500 a month, justifiably, in the law's eyes, for that same plan. So am I going to pay that? Absolutely not. There's no way. I will pull out of the system. I will buy an indemnity plan, which is not regulated by the health insurance law, which is just a set amount. It basically puts the insurance company's risk at a minimum level. There's a caps on everything, where right now there's not caps on the major plans. So I'll buy an indemnity plan just so I have something, which is going to pay me a little bit every time I need to go to the doctor for something.
Well, let me just interrupt you there. I mean, there is so much here. And, you know, obviously, being in the business, you have a handle on a good portion of it. But it's like I said, if this turns out to be, you know, worst case scenario, that everybody's that is insured, you know, has a private insurance plan through their company or are paying for it themselves, it winds up tripling, it's going to be a disaster. It's going to be a political and financial disaster. Yeah. And is it anything that that will, like, sink the country or whatever? No. I mean, it won't at all. I mean, this is the wealthiest country in the world. It actually has a lot more flexibility to it than than it appears, and it can be fixed. So I think we're going to, you know, it's like I say, I'm putting this all in the back of my brain. I'm listening to what Brian says. I'm, you know, my knowledge of insurance is fairly limited. Yeah. So, you know, I guess we can say we'll wait and see.
Yeah.
Well, I got to go on to some other people, but I thank you for all that, Brian. I appreciate it very much. Let's go to where there is socialized medicine. I'm sorry. This is Chuck in Auburn Hills. I thought this was Eric in Windsor. He hung up. But, Chuck, go ahead. You're on the air. You're on the air.
Yeah, okay. Obamacare is not going to work. I think that the Republicans and Justice Roberts know that. It's a ploy for the Republicans to make this fail. They're not going to let the people get what they want. They're not going to let the people get what they deserve. This is a real smooth move by them to make Obama a failure and to get him not elected. And it's a trick. The Republicans.
It makes one wonder, doesn't it, Peter?
Well, I'll tell you, Chuck, I mean, it's not going to fail between now and November.
Because it's not going on until 2014.
Yeah, because all of the aspects that are in place now are very popular with people. What has people confused, and I'm sure, you know, what Brian was saying, you know, being the insurance agent, I mean, my head begins to swim a little. Well, I don't know. Will things go up triple? I don't know. I mean, maybe they will. What's going to happen when another 30 million people enter the health system? I mean, is it going to overwhelm it? I mean, if the health system right now is set up to handle 30 million less, what's going to be the consequences of 30 million people more entering it?
As we say, we don't know.
They're scare tactics. That's what it is. They're going to use scare tactics. We don't have to wait till 2014.
Well, yeah. And it's like I said, all of this is fixable. I mean, if the American people think that what's his name? Mitt Romney, right?
Yes. Good job.
Mitt Romney can somehow magically create jobs and somehow get us out of our health crisis. You know, we'll see. I doubt it. Well, I mean, I think things will worsen significantly.
Please.
What?
Yes, they will worsen significantly. Please. Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Chuck. I appreciate your call. I was trying to get to Eric from Windsor. I think he's, if I'm correct in who he is, he's called in before. And, you know, it's because even a lot of Michiganders have some misconceptions about the
Canadian
healthcare.
Yeah,
healthcare.
Sure. We hear it all the time.
They're all coming over here.
Right.
You know, and
all of them are coming over here. Right.
No wonder there's such a lineup at the Bridge and Tunnel.
It's all for healthcare.
They're not coming to the rock concerts.
Yeah, right.
All right. Here's Gary in Rochester. Gary, hi. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, how you doing?
We're good.
Good.
Hey, I've got a couple of things to say. You guys probably aren't going to agree with some of it, but
it's okay.
Yeah.
First off, I'd like to say that I'm a proud conservative. Conservatives teach people how to fish. Liberals take your fish and give it to people unwilling to fish.
Can we not say cliches?
Unwilling to fish? What the hell is that?
Yeah, you mean like all the people?
Because we're lazy liberals? We care about those lazy poor people?
Are you talking about all the people that people, you know, had their jobs ruined by these big corporations that wanted to go pay people a dollar and a quarter an hour and then they lost their job? You know, anyway, let me tell you something,
Gary.
Anyway,
you smell like fish.
As someone who argues for a living, repeating cliches is really a poor way to begin. But try again.
Okay, well, it's the truth. Anyways, companies are not going to want to hire under Obamacare because their rates are going to go up for insurance. So that's going to be bad news there.
Where'd you hear this? Where'd you get that?
Wait a minute, I didn't even hear it. I was just kind of...
Companies are not going to want to hire people because they're going to have to pay for more insurance.
That is a Romney contention, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
No, first of all, who's going to pay for the free health care?
You know, I don't know, but the Congressional Budget Office says that this will all pay for itself through a series of tax increases on people with incomes over $250,000.
People who can afford it.
Yeah, you know, somebody like maybe, you know, that guy, what's his name?
Which one?
Tim Cook, or the guy that's head of Apple now.
Makes I think it is Tim Cook.
$387 million a year.
Yeah, I mean, it's not even a blip.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's talk about the government for a second.
Sure.
How good they deal with everything. Everything our government touches, they screw up. And now we're going to trust them with their health care on top of it all?
Well, I don't know.
That's a pretty blanket, large statement.
I don't get it. You know, I mean, when the government didn't do much, you didn't have paved roads, you didn't have public schools, you didn't have social
security. What about your police force?
Police force, fire. higher, you know, and you know what? Most anything that becomes bureaucratized always has problems with it.
Yeah. It can't be flawless.
But if you don't think that private concerns, corporations, aren't just thoroughly inefficient frequently and make money at the same time.
Corrupt,
do the worst practices to the people that work for them.
Yeah.
And I mean, the reason government stepped in, got to remember, is that that food companies were selling poison food. They were working kids to death. They worked men and women 12 and 14 hours a day. When you were too old, they just threw you out and you wound up in a county workhouse. If capitalism would have been a humane society instead of a system of thorough exploitation of dog eat dog with the big dog eating all the little dogs, you wouldn't have needed all this government stuff. But because of the greed and the corruption and the horrible practices of capitalists, we had to have all this government protection.
Okay, well, let's talk about the tax money going towards abortions.
He ceded that point to me. I don't think any is. If you may remember,
I know who's had abortion just kind of pays for it themselves.
Yeah, if you may remember, the reason that the Affordable Health Care Act even passed the House of Representatives is because
they took that out of there.
Because the Democratic representative, what was his, I can't think of his first name, Stupak from the Upper Peninsula, got it taken out. So where's the government?
It's not in there. Yeah.
Where's the government paying for abortion? They should.
Yeah, sure.
But they're not.
Well, first of all, it's not the government that's going to be paying for it. It's going to be the taxpayers, the middle class working man.
Let me ask you a question. Do you have health insurance?
Yes.
Through your business or your work?
Yes, through my business. Yep. And you know what? I'm seeing my rates go up and my coverage is going down.
Well, you know what?
You and every other MF in this country.
Yeah, I mean, it's not that. That's the healthcare system we have now. That's why there should be a single-payer universal healthcare. It gets paid for by bringing, like Ron Paul said, take all the troops home from all across the world.
He was good on that.
Make a peace treaty on, you know, an anti-nuclear peace treaty. Get rid of all the nuclear weapons. Get all this, and we'll have the money to pay for everything. How in the world, are we the wealthiest country in the world, and we have the highest poverty rate in the world? Okay.
Wait, I have a question for him.
Go ahead.
Wait, why is it that you're a man and you're discussing my ovaries? Why are you interested in what's up in there, huh?
Hold on a minute. Now, that's kind of a strange question. I'm not interested in what's up in there. I'm interested in what my tax dollars are going towards.
Yeah, you're worried about what I'm doing with my own damn body. That's what you're worried about.
You're
worried about what women are doing, what's in between their legs.
Oh, my God. You're blowing things out of proportion.
No, I'm not. Because you're a man, and I'm a woman, so I blow it out of proportion, if you want to call that.
Well, here's the thing. It has nothing to do with being a man or a woman. We're talking about tax dollars going towards something
why don't you worry about your own
business? Did you ever hear of the Hyde Amendment? Hyde? Or what is that? Yeah, Hyde. I mean, they're next to nothing. Government funds rarely, if ever, go for abortion.
He's been watching Fox News, Peter.
That's like the importance of Planned Parenthood that provides those kind of services for women. I mean, it's a legal procedure. It's legal
Legal. You sounded like you said illegal.
It's legal in this country. It's a legal medical procedure.
They're trying to make it illegal in
Mississippi. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. All right, we got to move on. Appreciate your call. You're right. We did disagree with you.
Yeah, we did, just a little bit.
Here's Luke in Monroe. Luke, hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
Doing tonight.
Good.
Great.
Welcome. I always say the home of Fermi 1, 2, maybe, hope not,
maybe 3. Please.
And
no.
George W. Custer. Go ahead.
And
you're on the air.
What's up?
What's up?
I just wanted to talk about my health care a little bit. I'm in the skilled trades, and my health care is absolutely horrible.
Yeah? Uh-huh. Just like everyone else.
I pay between $15,000 and $20,000 a year in health care.
What? Why?
It's just horrible.
Why?
Why do you pay so much?
Well, that's just the way my union runs, and it's not a good deal at all. I go to the dentist. It costs me $100, no questions about a filling. I go take my kid to the doctor. It costs me $30 bill every time I go to take him for a runny nose or anything.
Yeah.
And I pay that much money, and I still have to pay those high premiums.
I don't understand that because, I mean, I think I pay
and
maybe.
Unions, I mean.
Yeah, I think what? I usually pay like 20, I think I pay like $2,500 to the company. Mm-hmm. And then there's like, you know, like you said, there's, you know, like $30 copays, but $20,000. I mean, that.
I have the copays and everything, and I also pay those. They're just obnoxious premiums, and I don't understand it. I don't see where that money's going.
So what's the insurance
well,
for you
wait.
And your
I know you know where it's going. It's going into the pockets of the people that invest in healthcare.
Yeah.
And that's why, I mean, that's one of the values of having this single-payer universal healthcare paid for by the government, like they do in Canada, like they do in England, like they do in France, like they do in
Germany,
Italy, like they do in Germany,
Norway,
like they do in
Denmark.
Sweden. Yeah, right. Okay, thank you very much. And here is Eric in Windsor making our program
is.
International. Hi, Eric. Thanks for calling back. You're on the air.
How's it going, guys? I was just coming off of that, what you were talking about, the battleships in Windsor. I mean, the battleships in Canada.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, I've had health coverage my whole life. You know, it's just been pretty much taking care of me, you know. Like, I've never had to worry about it. It's just there.
Beautiful.
And I understand it. It's harsh where you guys are. You know, you guys have to pay for your stuff. But at the same time, you know, I'm a Canadian citizen. I'm not the government. Like, all of our governments make mistakes. Wasting money on stupid things, and I just didn't like how you guys went to the whole, you know, you'll take the only people that'll want to take us over is you guys. Like, come on, I listen to you guys all the time and I like your show.
We were joking.
No, what I meant
we're
was
we're not going to closest enemy, and that we are warmongers as a country.
Wait, here's what I meant, Eric. And I'm surprised you haven't heard this before. I said I thought that Canada wastes tens of billions of dollars a year having a military, which it doesn't need. The only country it's contiguous with is the United States. The United States has contingency plans to invade and occupy Canada the way it has contingency plans to invade and occupy Mexico, Europe,
Russia,
Asia,
yeah.
Everything. I mean, that's in the Pentagon. I'm not saying that they're planning it or it's
going to
happen.
And it's not going to.
But they're not, given a certain set of circumstances, they don't want to be caught off guard. No other country in the world has anything like that. So the only thing I was saying is that there's no reason for a Canadian military except that it wastes a lot of money. Usually when I say that the Canadians say, well, we're a peacekeeping force. Well, take your choice. You can either have better health care services or you can send troops to Afghanistan.
We love you, Eric. Don't be mad at us.
Okay, I see where you're coming from now. I totally do.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
So, wait a minute. Right, go ahead.
It's weird because I've never heard you talk much about Canada when I do listen to the show. And
we talk about Canada quite
here,
a bit.
Here, I'm going to talk about Canada right now. Join me with the I can't remember what this stands for suddenly, but I'm going to be hosting, as I always do, the State of the Detroit River Boat Tour, the CEA. Why can't I remember what that stands for? Guys, don't kill me.
Is it environmental something?
Yeah, it's an environmental cruise, and if you go to my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com, it's going to happen Saturday, July 14th, noon to 4 o'clock. It's $30, includes a dinner, and we always have a great Citizens Environment Alliance. Thank you.
Entertainment by Peter Werbe. Yeah,
well, I'm just the pretty face that's going to. And we go up and down the river, and we have these environmental experts. And
he is kind of pretty.
Interestingly enough, it's usually good news. I mean, there's always bad news because
I love
these
that
polluters.
The good news.
Yeah, yeah. So thinking about joining us, Eric, and thanks for making our show international. Appreciate it. Any more Canadians? What do you think about what I'm advocating? Just disband the military. You don't need it. It's a waste of money. 313-298-WRIF is our phone number. Here is Steve in Farmington. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you doing?
We're good.
The first time caller, but
welcome.
I was calling because I heard a guy talking about earlier about getting to the beginning of it. You know, I understood when I was a kid, my dad worked with the Boilermakers and they had good insurance. And we was able to see dentists every 6 months. You go to a doctor, the doctor had everything there. They did allergy tests, sewed you up. You know, the doctor's office maintained one office with everything in it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And now, it wasn't long ago, I had to have a tumor removed out of my back.
Oh, wow.
And I couldn't even tell you. It was probably 7 or 8 different places that I went.
Like the MRI and then the this and the that. And
building after building after building of taking different tests. You got to go here for this test. You got to go there for that test. You got to come here for this test. And the insurance was being billed so much that just to take a tumor out, it was like $60,000-some when it was all done and said.
Boy. Well, you know, somebody was making money all the way along the line, and it wasn't you.
Right.
Yeah, and if they could consume some of the stuff back over the way it was and bring it to, instead of having it so bashed out and this is a specialist, so it's going to cost this much money. Your insurance covers this much, so now you owe a certain amount of money because this is a specialist. That's the way my insurance worked then.
Yeah. The bureaucracy, say it for me, Peter.
Bureaucracy.
Has become more bureaucratic.
Yeah. And, well, I mean, it is just a mechanism to siphon more money out of us as individuals and out of our companies and out of our tax revenues. It's, well, we'll see. I'd like, so we were talking about, Steve, I don't know what is going to happen with the Obamacare. Hopefully it will make things better. We'll see. But thanks for your call.
Fingers crossed.
Now, I never know what to make of this. Richard writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. He says, turn up the caller's volume. It's hard to hear them.
I think Richard's the only one. Maybe, I think you need, are you turning them up?
They're up. They're
same levels as we have. Do I need to come over there?
No, you can see it. But I'm just curious here.
We got a bunch of you.
Remember, Brian, the insurance guy, said that he's going to have to pay triple his insurance.
Yeah.
And Robert writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. The guy is BSing you, Peter. He's not going to have to pay more insurance than what he's paying now.
So is he like the Fox News of our show or
what? No, I don't know. I mean, I don't think he's sitting there. I don't, with all due respect for both of you, I don't think, you know,
I think Brian says it.
And remember the guy that was the proud conservative? Hi, Peter and Jolene. Gigi writes in, that caller said that everything the government touches fails. Well, this guy should never get anything through the mail. He should never receive a Social Security payment.
Yeah,
there you
go. And Chris, I like this one. He said, what are we so afraid of? A healthy population. What an insane debate. I love that.
Terry writes in, this legislation is to put money in the pockets of consumers. Children who stay on their parents' plan until 26 will have more spending money. Caps on rates allow us to save and spend, which is one of the things that the Congressional Budget Office says as well. But like I said, folks, I mean, I'm really curious to see how this is all going to shake out.
Hey, and Rick in East Point, I have a question for you. What are you listening through? Are you listening through, good speakers or kind of little computer speakers or what?
Well, let's get some more people in on this. Give us an email. Are we way over what the callers in volume?
Is it us?
Yeah. Is it? I mean, I'm looking at these little lines.
I just wonder
bouncing.
How the processing is different in our headphones than goes out through, and every different radio is different.
Well, the process should pump them up regardless, right?
Yeah, it should be even, but I wonder what we're hearing in our headphones is, different because.
All right. Terry in Dearborn and Fred in Detroit, you hang on. We're going to come back. Want to talk more about, in fact, I'm surprised. I thought more people were going to ask me, maybe that because I've promised to say I don't know, but we're going to ask more things like, will this affect me? What will happen if
we've got lots of information, but, and also we do have some open lines. This is our final segment of the show. So 313-298-WRIF.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jolene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this. This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan.
Thank you very much, and this is our final segment, so give us a call at 313-298-WRIF. I asked people to call in and tell us whether or not they could hear the callers as well as they could hear
Jolene
and I. DeKalvitz writes in, I hear them fine, the callers, on BlackBerry. Richard, Rick, as you call him, says listening online through surround speakers.
Surround, okay.
Means nothing to me.
Well, that's what that's the basis.
Adam writes in, the callers are really quiet. I just trust what Peter says to know what the caller said. Is that right? What?
Wow. Yeah. You know what I think you should do, Peter? Let's try this for the last segment.
What? Really?
An experiment. Okay. Crank them all the way to the top.
Yeah, okay. Your caller volume is consistently much lower than your volume.
See?
Much lower. This is terrible.
I think it's operator error. I think it's
what? That's me, dude.
I think it's Peter Werby.
Yeah. The caller's volume is always about 75% of your volume.
See? We're going to crank it.
Snowman says.
We're experimenting, and then you tell us what you think.
David says, he was right. The callers are very quiet. I'm listening to you guys with 5.1 surround sound. The people in the apartment next door can hear your voices. I can hardly hear the callers' voices.
Bad. Okay.
All right.
First of all, we're going to experiment with this right now.
Yeah.
For the last segment. And then let us know what you think, because we got to work this out. And if not, we're going to talk to engineering.
Yeah. I want to give a shout out to Stuart, who's listening in Hayward, California. He sent us some articles.
One's from the Washington Times,
which
is not a credible resource whatsoever. The Washington Post is. The Washington Times is run by the Moonies.
Yeah.
I love the Moonies. I danced with the Moonies in Chicago.
What?
I did.
The Moonies don't dance.
The Moonies. Yes, they do. They do dance. Yes, they dance.
All right.
They dance a lot.
The Calvis writes in, call Obamacare Romneycare was his idea. Well, yes and no. As we said earlier, it was from the Conservative Heritage Foundation. It was introduced into Congress by conservative Republicans. This whole idea of an individual mandate that people are saying, there goes our freedom.
And your guns.
And
get all paranoid.
And, of course, Romney was the one who successfully brought it about in Massachusetts, Romney Care. But he says, well, it's a state. Well, what the hell? I don't get it.
It's an idea, dude.
All right, let's go back to our phones and see what's up. Okay, we're gonna go right to Terry in Dearborn. Go ahead, Terry, you're
all
on
the way.
There.
Crank it.
Hey, hello. As a good liberal, it's frustrating to hear people call in who don't understand the Health Care Act.
Yeah.
But it's even worse when people have false information on it.
Absolutely.
Thanks to the conservatives.
Like what? What do you hear that's really false?
Hey, Peter, did you turn this one down?
Well, for instance, the guy saying, oh, my health care costs $500 right now, it could triple.
Yeah.
Well, see, here's why it won't triple, because there's a mandate. Everyone who's healthy has to buy in. That's going to keep the rates down. And here's the Health Care Act in a nutshell. If you don't have insurance or if you can't get it, the government will help you get it. If you can't afford it, the government will help you pay for it.
Or in many cases, you'll be eligible for Medicaid, and you'll have it. Yeah.
Well, they'll subsidize up to like $80,000 in income. They'll help you pay for your health.
Right, up to 400% of the poverty level of $20,000.
Right.
Yeah.
Correct. Well, so even if the smart guy's insurance does triple, which it won't, but if it does, he'll still be able to afford it, because if he's not making a lot of money, like he said, then the government will help him pay for it. It won't hurt him.
Yeah, you know, actually, that's very, very astute. I didn't think of that. If it did go up to that rate, and one of the, I forgot, I was going to read this from the New York Times, a Q&A. What will happen to my insurance premiums? It says, most consumers can expect to keep seeing increases in premiums and copayments because the underlying cost of health care is expected to rise.
As it is right now, before any of this goes into it, it's happening.
And whether or not we have that or not, and whether if Romney repeals it all, it'll still be going up. Probably more, right?
So far.
Yes.
Well, so far, if the insurance companies are making more, so they're refunding money.
Yeah.
So if their profits are above 20%, they refund money. If their profits dip below 20%, they charge more. The government helps you pay for it. It's a win-win all the way around. It's a foolproof plan. And if I could remind you, you mentioned the attack on freedom. Go back to Ronald Reagan in 1962. Medicare was the end of freedom in America so bad that we're going to sit around in our rocking chairs talking about how Medicare ended freedom in America. Their arguments are bankrupt. They're absurd. They're asinine. And they're bringing out the same old asinine arguments again.
Yeah, and it's just, once again, these fear tactics. And like you said, the Fox News misinformation.
Yeah. By the way, who reported that the law had been overturned. initially.
They did. So did CNN.
CNN, yeah. And you got to remember, and
those producers need to have their asses fired.
But Terry,
or handed to them.
I don't know if you've heard the show regularly, but I say at least every other show, maybe every show, but the conservatives have been on the wrong side of every social question since the beginning of this country. They've always tried to conserve what is, whether it was our status as colonies, or they tried to conserve slavery, or they, they tried to
all of these horrific things.
They've always been wrong. You know what? And you know what, Terry?
And evil.
I challenge conservatives. Now, you know, we always just think of conservatives as being pretty dumb. I mean, some of them, you know, have
greedy. There's greedy. Yeah, there's evil.
One of the things I challenge them to indicate somewhere in American history where they were right about something.
So have we ever gotten one?
No. Never
I didn't think
one.
So. We've been trying all of these years.
All right, Terry. Thank you very much. well said, too. 313-298-WRIF. Here is Fred in Detroit. Hi, Fred. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hello, Peter and Jolene.
Hi.
Okay, I'm going to run through this quick, so just hang on.
Okay,
all right,
Fred.
Sitting back.
We're having to put my feet up. Go for it.
Well, I just wanted to say to Ken, the tax cutter, it's been tried. It's called Reaganomics. Yeah. And it was more trickle on than trickle down.
But triple up, a trickle up.
Oh, he's talking about being peed on.
And, I got you. Sorry.
Right. Golden showers.
Yes. The man, the fish cliche. He's really a poor student of actual American history. and as the insurance guy, you've heard me say it's ridiculous that an MRI costs 10 times as much in California as it does here. And then overall, there's so much waste, and you mentioned there's so much waste and price gouging in an American market economy.
Yeah, it's
and
a racket.
They pay higher prices than people do for our goods overseas.
Right. Hey, Fred. Fred, did you happen to see the story about the White House guest who flipped off the portrait of Reagan?
Not to hear that.
Yeah, it was on Monday. Well, on Monday, the White House, as it says, verbally rapped the knuckles of a pair of guests who posed for photographs giving former President Ronald Reagan's portrait the one-finger salute. It was while attending a reception there a week ago.
And they also...
Oh, it was a gay pride reception. And they're right about this, because he did ignore the AIDS epidemic. I don't care what anybody says. And you know what? My friend Jimmy might be here if it weren't for that jerk.
Thank you, Fred. Appreciate your call, as always.
What? What, Peter?
Should we?
Come on.
I don't even... Rick, I don't even know why we bother with you sometimes.
Rick,
but Rick, East Point Rick, he's got... I think he's gone apolitical.
We better turn him all the way up so he doesn't yell at us.
Go ahead,
okay. Rick. Okay, so I do air conditioning work... work for a living, and I went in.
Well, now I know who to call.
What he does? What for a living?
Air conditioning. I don't know if I want Rick in my house, though.
Yeah.
Anyway,
I'm kidding. I've met him in person.
So I go to this place. It's a headquarters for a Democrat woman who is running for Congress, and I fix her air conditioner. And when I get done, I go in, and the guy, and I'm wearing a Ron Paul T-shirt.
Oh boy!
And the guy,
I've seen that
the
shirt.
The guy says, "You've got a lot of nerve wearing that shirt in here." And I says, "Well, you know, this Ron Paul's not all that bad with Democrats. I mean, there's some things that, you know, some of them actually like." And so we get to talking, and we're mostly disagreeing, but we're being friendly about it. And then a woman from the back of the office comes, and she's got a white T-shirt on. It says "Vagina" in big letters.
Says what?
Vagina.
Vagina.
Well, yeah, that's, you know what that's
right
about, right?
Yeah, it was right after the rally.
Okay, so do you have a problem? Do you have a problem
anyway,
with that?
No, I have no problem with that.
Here he goes. Here's where he wants to know our opinion.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Okay. So, anyways, I asked her. I said, "Well, can I ask you honestly? Aren't you just a little bit disappointed with Obama and the fact that we still have Guantanamo, we still have the wars, we still have the spying and the drones?"
Yeah.
And the woman says, "Have you ever heard of the Patriot Act?" And I was going to tell her, "Well, yeah, I know about the Patriot Act. Obama extended it. He also signed an NDAA." And so I says to her, "Honey," and then she says, "Did you call me honey?"
You called her honey? Did you really?
Yeah. Well,
Oh, boy.
She held the door open and she's out. Get out of here. Good day, sir. She got very offended by me calling her honey.
Yeah.
And I'm like,
well, feminists don't really dig that, by the way.
Yeah. Well,
strangers.
I thought you called her sweetie.
No, I called her honey. Okay. I called her honey.
I just say, honey.
And go on with, you know, Patriot Act that's been extended.
It's demeaning. It's demeaning to a woman to do that.
Well, let me tell you, he lost me at honey. On one hand,
go back to vagina.
You might think, gee, she overreacted and she ought to just deal with it. On the other hand, it probably was, as you found out, not the wisest thing to say, right?
No, but I'm not offended. I mean, I've had like a waitress tonight call me honey. I've talked to gay guys before. They call me sweetie. What? I'm not offended.
I don't know. In Baltimore, there is...
What, did you call him fruity and they liked it?
The waitresses and a lot of people call... they call women huns, H-O-N.
Uh-huh.
In fact, after my mother passed away, my dad remarried, and we didn't know what to expect or what her politics were, and then we realized she was part of a group called Huns for Peace.
Oh, gosh.
You know, and she's an older woman, obviously, right?
She was cool with it.
And then we also used to go to this place in Baltimore called the Hun Cafe, H-O-N. But my advice to you...
And waitresses are just friendly. They call people hun.
They call people hun. My advice is slice it any which way, but I would drop that. All right, Rick, thank you very much.
Peter, you know how I take to it if a man calls in here and tries starting that honey stuff with me.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I mean,
I was like, I have a name, okay? It's Julene.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, also, it is without in, and maybe you didn't even intend it. It's not uncommon, but it has a demeaning connotation to someone you don't know.
Like, hon, calm down.
On the other hand, I know couples that call each other sweetie and honey and all that. It is a term of endearment. You did not mean it as a...
Right.
Because...
It was honey.
What's the equivalent? I mean, what could she say? Well, I mean, she probably could say, look, Buster, and think about that. I mean,
she could come up with a few things, I'm sure.
Yeah. Okay, here is Mike in Jackson. Hey, you're on the air. Hi.
Hello.
Don't call me honey. Go ahead.
Don't call me late for lunch.
Okay, I'm in Jackson, and I've been approached by people with clipboards for signatures for bail initiatives.
Right.
I've listened to them a little bit, and really I want to try to help my friend because she's doing it in any way I can. What are the bail initiatives, the issues, especially the bridge?
Okay. There's a bridge initiative they're trying to get that something on the ballot about that? I thought that was a done deal. You mean the bridge across the Detroit
bridge.
River?
Correct. The proposed U.S./Canada bridge.
Right.
That's one of them that people have been telling me about, the signature people. And then there's one that they can't raise taxes without us saying so.
Okay.
And
they're going to make collective bargaining part of a guarantee part of the Constitution. Mm-hmm. That's on there. Yeah.
That's a good one.
What happened to legalized marijuana? Aren't we doing that?
You mean completely?
Or whatever.
Oh.
I think they should decriminalize it like Ann Arbor.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you can still get a ticket there.
But it's better than jail time.
And they've actually closed 500 dispensaries in California.
Oh, in California.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So
that's tough. That's a tough one. So what do you think?
I was asking, what's your take on the bridge? Do you propose U.S. Canada bridge?
Well, I thought it was a done deal.
To give old Mr. Richie Rich a little run for his money.
Yeah, I thought the deal was that they agreed to do it, that Canada would put up the money and collect the tolls, and it would pay for it. Isn't that what was happening?
Yeah, that was my understanding too.
Yeah.
Huh.
Well, I mean, you know, get those damn trucks somewhere else. We don't want this to be like Tijuana or something. Sitting there in a line, I mean, that is so out of control. I mean, waiting for like an hour, hour and a half to, you know, you've had this wonderful vacation in Canada and then you come there and you're sitting there for an hour and a half. And I don't know, what are they saying to these people? You know, I start timing it because, you know, we know, like, for instance,
whatever
on radio,
say.
You know, sometimes you'll go, whoa, I got 60 seconds till I'm on the air. And you can do a lot in 60 seconds.
It's like an hour in radio.
It's like an hour in radio time. So I'm timing somebody, and they're talking to people 6 and 7, 8 minutes at the booth.
Yeah.
They were, you know, and we roll up, and they say, you know, where do you live? Where were you born? Where, you know, how long were you in Canada? Blah, blah, blah. Okay, thank you. I'm going. This is under a minute. What were they talking to those other people for 6 or 7 minutes for?
I've no idea. Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much. At least it's not a bridge to nowhere. It's a bridge to somewhere.
At least it's not Alaska and Sarah Palin.
Yeah. Here's Bruce in Southgate. Hey, Bruce, you're on the air.
How you doing?
We're good.
Good. Hi, Bruce.
My big thing is, you know, all these people keep getting on the news and complaining about the government is forcing us to buy insurance. Well, what about car insurance? They've forced us for years to buy car insurance.
True.
But you know, and you know why?
And health insurance actually is good for us.
And it's the same reason. The same reasoning is that the more people that pay into it that don't have accidents, then allows these companies to exist to do the payouts of the people that do have accidents. Same thing here. You got to have a lot of healthy people in the system that aren't getting payouts. I mean, we hope. I mean, we all want health insurance, right? Through like our forget about Obamacare. I mean, before this, we all wanted health care through our employment. But we sure as hell hope we never, ever had to use it, right?
Other than for going to the office for regular routine stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Do you have health insurance?
Yeah, I do. I'm a union sheet metal worker.
Oh, cool.
And I pay a little over $6 an hour for my health insurance.
Well, depending on how much you make per hour,
I don't know. So that's why I'm just $240.
Well, we're not asking.
Wait a minute. Are you? You're paying $12,000 a year.
Yeah.
Wow, man. You got to get some new negotiator.
The second union guy.
Our health insurance, though, is we're subsidizing the retirees.
Oh.
Okay.
So they don't pay as much money for their insurance.
Right. Well, and we want that.
Yeah. That's why. My total package for work is right around $50 an hour.
Yeah.
And I want to tell you, that better happen for you, too.
I'm hoping, but it probably won't.
I hope it does.
Well, one of the things we all got to do is, I mean, we're all hoping. I mean, see, everybody just hopes that, that Obama and the Democrats do this or that Romney and the Republicans do that. I mean, we don't hope the Republicans do that. But there's very infrequently are we inserting ourselves into this process. I mean, if you're part of a union, you are to some extent, and you have already an organization there that's involved in all this. But we can just kind of sit back and watch the elites figure out what they are going to do for us. Are they going to help us or hurt us? Are they going to help us a little?
Bad idea.
Yeah. So the more we can be active in the process, the better.
Yes.
All right, Bruce, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Going up to Flint, speaking about unions, where it all began in the late 1930s, here's Steve. Steve, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
We're good.
Hey, I got a question for you.
Sure.
One thing.
What?
Oh.
How does putting a middleman between the purchaser and the provider cut costs?
Well, answer your question. You're saying this is what is coming about?
Absolutely. You're increasing the middleman's stake in the game.
No, what you're doing is you're allowing 30 million people who currently don't have health care in the United States to have what they deserve and get health care. That's what we're doing.
But what are you saying, Steve, that the cost, you think the costs are going to go up?
Let me ask you this. So what you're saying is health care is more important than being healthy?
Health care is
part of being healthy.
Yes,
it is. Yes, it absolutely is. It's a little thing called preventative health care.
Yeah, that's part of the plan. I mean, if you have a plan now, you get all of that all that done for free. But tell me, rather than asking me questions, what's your concern here? Just say it out as a
He just had a question.
I think you guys are spreading ridiculous propaganda.
Oh,
and
really?
Wait.
You're trying to convince the younger generation that this is a good thing when it's not.
Well, wait a minute.
Telling facts. You can't argue with facts. I hate to tell you that.
Well, how is this propaganda if we're simply saying, well, two things. We're simply saying what the act itself says. And the second thing I've said, I don't know how much of the show you heard, but I did say at one point, it's possible that what the critics say about this could turn out to be true. And then it's fixable. I mean, you repeal it. I mean, that's what Mitt Romney says. Day one, as soon as I win, which I don't think he's gonna, he's gonna get rid of it. So
well,
that,
maybe based on this this healthcare thing. Hey,
so it's always a possibility. Or if something creates costs where it wasn't expected, that can be dealt with. But it's not propaganda to repeat the terms of the act and to say that it's constitutional and say this is what it says it will provide. How's that propaganda?
Well, let me just put it this way. I have had health insurance, and I've had no health insurance in the past 5 years. Okay,
yeah.
I was able to get major surgery done for $3,000 without health insurance. Okay, now they were going to charge me if I had had health.
You were
insurance,
damn lucky.
They were going to. No, I'm not. It's everybody can do it. You talk to the doctor. You say I don't have insurance. They charge you a reasonable rate. They charge insurance that much because they can get away with it.
Well, that's one of, that's the abuse, and that's what's got to be stopped.
And like, not everyone can find that. Not everyone can find a doctor who's willing to do that
and
for you
know
by
what?
Any means. You are lucky.
You know, one in two people, 50% of this country is either poor or near poor in terms of the standards. People don't have $3,000 to insurance. And why should we have to be scrambling? Why shouldn't that be our birthright? Why shouldn't there be universal single-payer health care?
Yeah.
Like every other damn country in the world.
Industrialized nation in the world.
All right. I got to go, Steve.
See,
but thank you very much.
This is just going to continue to get uglier with all the lies that are being spread about this and the crap that people are believing. You know your sources. And you know, it's not Peter and I who are spreading lies.
Yeah.
It's Fox News. It's the Republican Party.
And as I said, you know, I mean, one of the things I want to thank all of you for, including the people that don't like this, you weren't, hysterically saying that our freedoms are down the drain. In fact, if you think about it, everybody that called in that objected to this did it purely on financial grounds, saying that, and who knows? I'm not saying this is 100% going to work. I know it'll work. Is that what I just said? This single payer universal health care.
Well, it's just going to have to work its kinks out as it goes along. And just like I said, like the medical marijuana laws.
All right. We're going to go work some kinks out somewhere else. You do the same.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Hey, Athena, thanks for doing this.
Thank you.
We'll be
and
doing
thanks
this
to everyone for calling in tonight. We'll do it again.
Yeah.
Next week.
All right. You know what I didn't? In fact, at the last moment, I started turning the callers up. Did that sound any better?
I got a couple of emails from listeners who said when you crank them all the way up, it's way better.
Okay.
I knew I was right on along. Why don't you listen
but
to
me? But is it better or good?
It sounds balanced and even when you crank the callers all the
all
way.
Right.
Just listen to me, Peter.
All right. Next week we do it again. Stay tuned for the interviews.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. You know, I was driving down the street the other day and I saw a guy in big Ford 150, angry looking guy, and it had a bumper sticker on the back of it that said, "I don't trust the liberal media." And when we think about how key media is and think about the word itself, it's a medium between reality and our comprehension of it. It reports to us. And in every period of contestation, of revolt, of rebellion, from colonial days, there always were newspapers, magazines, letters of correspondence, if you will, where people traded ideas and usually gave different versions of official reality. Someone once said the power is the ability to define reality. Wow, I'm going to let you chew on that one for a while. During the 1960s, as I'm sure many of you know, and if you don't know, this is going to be an exciting interview for you, there was a robust, what was called underground press, taking its name in many ways from the World War II underground. They were the quintessential papers of revolt and revolution, and covered a whole range of subjects, civil rights and anti-war movement, the women's movement, the gay movement, prisoners movement. In fact, I think I'm going to let our guest expand the list a little. And if for, what do they say, full disclosure, I have been and associated with one of them, which is now the longest running so-called underground paper in American history. It's called The Fifth Estate. You can go to fifthestate.org. Joining me is Ken Wachsberger, and he's the founder of Azemphany Press. He's a member of the Independent Book Publishers Association. He's a longtime writer, editor, author, also a political organizer, as well as a mentor, a book contract advisor. He is a busy guy. I saw his, he came in with his, what do you call those books, Ken? That right there is a Daily Planner. It just scared me. It just raised my, raised my anxiety level. He's a former national officer of the National Writers Union, and the book, the series are called Voices from the Underground. It's a pleasure to welcome Ken Wachsberger to the Peter Werby Show. Ken, welcome.
Well, thanks, Peter. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, the particular book we're talking about is called Insider's History of the Vietnam Era Underground Press, of which the Fifth Estate and almost 500 others were part of. And this is part two. So there's lots in this series. The series is called Voices from the Underground, and you can go to voicesfromtheunderground.com. But so you actually have direct experience in this. You're not writing as an historian.
I was an insider myself. I was active primarily on the underground press from the Lansing area. But I traveled around the country. I hitchhiked all over the place. I always seemed to end up on college towns. Wherever I ended up, though, there was an underground paper, and I always gravitated towards it. So I became familiar with underground papers all over the country.
Now, we were talking before the broadcast, Ken, about there's hopefully great numbers of people that were 20 years old today. It means they were born in 1992. Most of these papers began or ceased to publish in the early 1970s. So we could be talking about the 1930s or the 1880s if you're 20 years old. Sketch out for us the scope of the so-called underground press and actually what they were. I mean, describe them. They were tabloids. I mean, this was an unusual undertaking for young people to be involved in.
Well, the format was similar to what, say, the Detroit Metro Times is today. In fact, the Detroit Metro Times, they don't talk about it a lot, but they're actually successors to the underground press. First paper that's considered what we call the underground press was the Los Angeles Free Press, and that came out in 1964, I believe it was. The Fifth Estate was right behind it. It was one of the first. And as Peter said, it's still going on.
Detroit's Fifth Estate, yeah.
Yeah, Detroit's Fifth Estate. Harvey Ofshinsky, who was the founder of it, was from Detroit. His family had moved out to Los Angeles, and he'd felt a little alienated walking around just trying to get his bearings, and he came across the L.A. Free Press. And it was not long after that when he came back to Detroit and founded the Fifth Estate here.
And one of the difference was, of course, the content between, say, the L.A. Free Press and the Los Angeles Times. Just give us a little brief idea, or difference between the Fifth Estate of 1965 and the Detroit Free Press or the Detroit News of that era.
Well, the underground press covered, first of all, of course, the anti-war movement. As Peter was mentioning, there were underground papers representing lots of different voices. You had the gay press, the lesbian press, the feminist, the black, the Native American, the Puerto Rican, the military underground press, the New Age, the rank and file, all of them speaking to different audiences, but they also all were united by their opposition to the war. So Fifth Estate was, you know, that was one of the major issues they covered was the war, but the Fifth Estate also covered all of these liberation movements going on.
And culturally, I mean, Gary, if you think of the Detroit Free Press or news back then, there was no calendar of events, certainly not rock and roll concerts. There was no mention of rock and roll in there. They were Perry Como-ized back then. And so papers like the Los Angeles Free Press, the Fifth Estate in Detroit, and 500 others were into what was then the youth culture, much of what we take for granted today, right?
Very much, very much. The underground press helped to build the youth culture. We hear a lot about Woodstock, the great event that was. There was no advertising whatsoever for the Woodstock festival in any of the what we call the straight media, the corporate press. None at all. It was all in the either word of mouth or in the underground press.
Yeah, the Woodstock people took out full page ads
in, all over the country,
in the fifth estate, yeah. Right. We're talking with Ken Waxberger. He's edited Insider Histories of the Vietnam Era Underground Press, Part 2, and Voices from the Underground. You can go to voicesfromtheunderground.com. It's published by the Michigan State University Press, and there'll be a link on my website as well. And did I just say, I can always say this any number of times, I may have just said it, voicesfromtheunderground.com. And this is available at bookstores pretty much around everywhere, yeah?
Hopefully. Well, yeah, it's, academic presses don't really distribute that well, but you can always order through books in print at the bookstore.
And
so,
this,
yes,
this is some exciting reading. There is an account, and of course, you know, I have my my own dog in the fight, if you will, having worked with and still work with the Fifth Estate newspaper. Actually, it's a magazine now in Detroit. And there is a wonderful piece by a former Fifth Estate staff member, Bob Hippler, called Fast Times in the Motor City, the First 10 Years of the Fifth Estate, 1965 to 1975. But there's a lot else there, isn't there? What else are we looking at in terms of content?
Well, some of the other stories, we're talking about the history of the Black Panther newspaper. Jonana Abron was the last editor. Actually, she was from Detroit, too. She was the last editor of the Black Panther newspaper. She was the one who sat down with Huey Newton, who was the founder of the Black Panthers, and said, you know what, Huey, it's time to hang it up.
Oh.
Yeah, but what a great story she tells. It begins where she's at his funeral, and she was one of the speakers, along with David Hilliard and Erica Higgins and Bobby Seale and some of them. And she was looking out at the crowd and seeing all the black shirts and black berets, and from there, the story becomes a flashback. It all began, and then she tells this amazing story. But really setting.
In the days of we are now of electronic media, this may even sound kind of quaint. But you have to remember that media, the medium between reality and us, was dominated solely, 100%, by the corporate press. There was a few radical newspapers, what was called the National Guardian and then the Guardian back in the 1960s. There were a few socialist and communist and anarchist papers, but barely making a blip on the radar. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons is that it was financially impossible for anyone other than part of a big organization like a union to put forth a newspaper with an alternative view. In fact, the underground press was also called the alternative press, but there was a technological advance that suddenly made this available to people like Harvey Ofshinsky, founding the Fifth Estate in 1965 when he was 17 years old, that started all. And that technological innovation was?
Offset printing.
Yeah.
what is blogging today is seen as the new technology. Actually, it's gone beyond blogging now, but blogging today is the bloggers today were, I would say, would be comparable to the underground press people of back when. The underground press is the successors. In fact, that's the reason in Insider Histories Part 1, one of the forewords was written by Marcos Moulitsas, who is the founder of Daily Kos, which is one of the major blog sites today. And it was deliberate. I wanted him to write the foreword because I wanted to symbolically connect the two generations. I'm quite convinced that bloggers today have no awareness of their own history. You know, what was going on in the media, the radical media, I should say, in the 60s, in the same way that a lot of us didn't know what was happening in the 30s. And so I invited Marcos, and he got back to me. I sent him a few stories. He got back to me and said, Ken, I'd love to write the piece, but I got to be honest, I don't know anything about the underground press. And I said, I know that, Marcos. I read your book. And it wasn't really a criticism of him as much as a criticism, let's say, of journalism history, you know, because he was a graduate of a journalism program, and he never learned at all about it. And that was really the goal that I had, that I wanted him to be able to read these stories and have this major awareness, wow, this was happening, and then write about it from that perspective. And so he agreed to write it, and he wrote a really nice piece.
So, Ken Waxberger, this is not just sort of a nostalgia piece for old folks who were there.
No, not at all. No, yeah. People, everybody draws lessons. I mean, and a lot of the people, it's nice to know, are still very active. You know, it's not, they didn't all become yuppified. You know, the yuppies who went away from the political scene. They didn't at all. The people who wrote these pieces were active back then, and they're still active now.
The book is Insider Histories of the Vietnam Era Underground Press. It's part two. It's part of the series Voices from the Underground. You can go to voicesfromtheunderground.com. There'll also be a link on my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. And you visited a lot of these sites where these presses were coming out. And in fact, I threw out the figure 500 regularly appearing underground alternative press tabloids. They almost all were at the time. Is that accurate? You buy that 500?
I'm pleased to say it's not even close. You asked me earlier what some of the other stories were in the book. One of the histories is about a paper called Above Ground, which was a military underground paper. It was put out in Fort Carson, Colorado, and the piece was written by Harry Haynes, who was one of the activists then, and he included a list of, as an appendix to his story, he included a list of 200 underground papers that were put out by military.
In the military?
In the military.
Opposing their participation.
All branches, every branch, the Marines, the Air Force, I mean, every branch, either put out by, published by members of the military or directed to them. And his list wasn't even near complete. He did his dissertation on the underground press, and those were the papers he came across. But in this edition here, his own appendix, the appendix of his list, has an appendix written by James Lewis, who is without a doubt the world expert on the military underground press, and he added some 300. So we now have, in these two lists, we have approximately 500 underground papers just put out by the military alone.
Anti-war papers in the military. If my memory serves me correctly, there were two anti-war newspapers being published on the USS Ranger. The aircraft carrier.
That could be. I can't tell you for sure, but
because these guys didn't agree politically.
Oh yeah, I know that happened. Yeah.
I mean, if you can imagine two competing anti-war newspapers on board a ship in the U.S. Navy, and I talked to people that served on the USS Ranger like 3 years after the war ended, they had no clue. I mean, it's not like that's going to be part of the official history. In fact, that kind of rebellious activity among the military is not exactly anything that the officials are.
Well, it was written out of history. That's why I'm trying to write it back into history.
Yeah.
I mean, these were really underground. I mean, the underground papers that we did, we used the term underground press. It was certainly, it has a certain romantic flair to it. We weren't killed the way you would be if you were, a Jew or a resistance fighter during World War II.
In the underground.
Underground. They were killed right away, you know, so we weren't, it wasn't quite the same. But when you wrote for the newspapers of the military, the alternative papers, the underground press, that really had to be secret. I mean, they were subjected to jail, to harassment, to, dishonorable discharge, to scorn within their own communities. They were rejected by members of the current, the already existing veterans groups.
Yeah. And there was there was like the Vietnam Veterans Against the War as opposed to the American
Legion. Well, that was an alternative
Legion.
Legion
or what have you. But there also was. There was an extraordinary amount of repression not of the type that you'd find in a military dictatorship, but enough that it started almost getting, up towards that level. I mean, there were a couple people killed.
Well, certainly the Black Panthers lost enough people.
Yeah. And also numerous break-ins by police agencies to get membership lists or subscriber lists, printers refusing to publish, to print the paper.
Oh, yeah, and the advertisers were pressured to not advertise also. One of the common advertisers in the early years was the record companies,
sure.
Discount Records. But then they were pressured to stop advertising. They started pulling ads.
Yeah. What did we used to say? The opposition to the Fifth Estate was the Big Four. It was parents, police, principals, and I can't remember the fourth one. Priests.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. That was the Big Four that opposed because of the content. And the content, I mean, you got to remember, we're talking about going from Ricky Nelson to people protesting naked. So there was a huge seismic cultural shift. That, I mean, everybody knows that in a way. You know, there were hippies and there was anti-war movement, there was civil rights movement, and I suspect some people may be going, yeah, I know that. But what you really don't know is, what it all took and what form it took. Because I would almost go so far to say that if it wasn't for the papers and the movements that are chronicled in the inside history of the Vietnam era underground press that Ken Wachsberger, my guest, has assembled, that could have maybe never happened. I mean, you had to get this information out, and it might have just remained like the beatniks of the 1950s, a number of cynical and sort of alienated individuals that never linked up. But and there was this symbiosis, if you will, between this burgeoning movement and also its ability to define the era.
Well, it had to come out. The information had to come out. What was interesting was that the information that came out in the underground press eventually made its way into the establishment press. And when it came out in the establishment press, it was often called a scoop. Ellsberg with the Pentagon Papers, that was incredible news to people who only read the mainstream papers. But for those of us who read the underground press, most of that was pretty well known already.
Yeah. Here's something that the underground press, the alternative press of Detroit, the Fifth Estate, missed. That in, if I'm trying to think of the right day, maybe 1968, there was a newspaper always delivered to the Fifth Estate that was called the Hanoi Courier, and it was published by the communist regime in Hanoi. It was sent to Czechoslovakia, and then with an attempt to influence, and we didn't buy their side of it particularly, that it would be distributed to papers they thought would be in opposition to the war. One banner headline was that United States troops had massacred this entire village called My Lai. And so here was the first notification of what now everybody knows as this horrible blot on the military in Vietnam called My Lai, where I forgot even the number. It was hundreds and hundreds of civilians were just mowed down by this Lieutenant Calley and his troop. We looked at it and we said, this is terrible. We can't print this. This is probably just commie propaganda. Even the people that were virulent opponents of the war were respectful of the men. I mean, contrary to the lies that were told, the anti-war movement supported the GIs and the anti-war GIs. GIs led every march. Active duty GIs led every big march, and there was always big veterans contingent. And we didn't go with it. So in terms of scoop, we missed the scoop. But in retrospect, I don't regret it because it would not have been well accepted.
Absolutely not.
Yeah. We just got a little bit of time left with Ken Wachsberger. Is there more in the hopper? I mean, you said there was at least 500 anti-war military papers being published during the 1960s and 1970s. I said I thought there was 500 regularly appearing tabloids, weeklies almost. I don't think any of them got to more than weekly. The Fifth Estate was a weekly and now comes out three times a year.
Right. There are a lot that operated under the radar. Underground Press Syndicate was the first nationwide network of underground papers, and that might have had 500 members at its peak. But there was a whole community of feminist and lesbian papers, not all of which were in UPS, but it was a whole community. In part two here, there's a story of It Ain't Me, Babe, which was a paper that came out of Berkeley. It was really the first national underground paper, or feminist underground paper.
Well, this, again, rather than, as you said, this is not about nostalgia. It's not, a historical curiosity that there were all these people putting their thoughts on paper, printed, the printed word, which everyone says now is an endangered species. And pretty soon, absolutely everything is going to be online. Sometimes those of us that still work on the Fifth Estate, we kind of say, we're the only remaining paper of that era that goes back so far. It's coming close to its 50th anniversary. Half a century of publishing is pretty good any way you cut it. But then when you look at it like that, when there's 499 that have dropped, one more and it's gone. Do you think there's a role for the for print still and alternative?
Well, absolutely. In organizing, clearly. I mean, blogs are great. They reach lots of people, and it's easy to write a blog, so anyone can get their opinion out. But for organizing locally, I still think that print is better. I mean, you can't hand somebody a blog, you know, and invite them to an event.
You know what? The quality of writing, I mean, there's good writing on blogs, but usually what happens is that the blogster writes it and then publishes it. When something comes into the Fifth Estate, it's maybe goes through as many as three or four editors. There's arguments sometimes about the editors, whether this should go in, whether this writing is bad, whether this political point is good or bad, you know, does it reflect all of our views? Mm-hmm. And then it's sent back to the writer, and the writer says, oh, I don't know, you can't cut that out. That's, you know, like that. Mm-hmm. So there's this, I mean, it's cumbersome. It's sometimes acrimonious. It's, you know, and people say, it's so simple. I just say whatever I want and whatever syntax I use, and boom, it's there. And to me also, as I the idea of just sort of kicking back with a newspaper, I like the idea, but I'm, you know, I could be a fossil.
Well, I'll never give up believing that editing is important. It's not to censor, it's to clarify. You know, I was the editor of this series. I wrote one of the pieces on the Lansing area Underground Press, but I edited all the other ones, and I was a serious editor. I mean, I dug deep in the editing, but it wasn't to censor as much as to say more. I mean, I would raise questions. What do you mean by this? Who's this? Can you expand here? You know, give me some quotes here. And what I was looking for was more information, not less, but I was trying to help them tell the story, and the end result is some amazing stories.
Well, of all the great writers, that whole period of great authorship between, say, the 1920s and, I don't know, maybe up into the 1960s, novels and novelists, they always, the authors, these great authors, you know, Hemingway and the rest, they always had incredible editors. I mean, legendary editors, in fact. And I do think the quality of writing is suffering. And sometimes people say to me, boy, that was such a good article, Pete, that you wrote. And I thought, well, you ought to give some credit to the other three or four people that just pulled out of me, and that the first version, if had I published that, would be kind of, mm-hmm. like that. So at some level, I read books and I'm going, did anybody edit this? You know, I'm talking fiction and nonfiction.
Lots of them, yeah.
Yeah, and people say, oh, how could this person write this? And I'm thinking, how could this go through the hands of an editor, through a major publisher, and not, you know,
It's the pros and cons of the new technology. It's real easy to get a book published, which is nice, but unfortunately some people go really too quickly to the publishing process without going through the editing process.
Well, this is a look at a movement of publication, seemingly, probably at least many of you, long ago and far away. It has, as Ken Wachsberger, my guest, has said, it has great bearing on today. And it is. I mean, that whole thing about not learning from the past.
Well, there's another reason why it's relevant to today, because amazingly enough, the war ended some 40 years ago. We're still fighting the Vietnam War. In fact, the government has just begun a new campaign to whitewash the horrors of the Vietnam War.
They call it the U.S. experience.
Is that what they call it? Yeah. President Obama kicked off the campaign with a speech May 28th, Memorial Day, at the Vietnam Wall. What they're trying to do is, you know, supposedly they're honoring the troops.
Yeah.
But what they're really doing is trying to glorify the Vietnam War as a noble event, and also to relegate the anti-war movement to a footnote written by a few crazies on the left.
Yeah.
And it wasn't. It was the broadest, most diverse anti-war community in the history of our nation.
Well, we're out of time with Ken Wachsberger. The book is Insider's History of the Vietnam Era Underground Press, Part 2. It's a part of the Voices from the Underground series. Voicesfromtheunderground.com is where you can go for more information. Go to my website as well. There'll be a link at Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. On the back, there's always blurbs. This is one worth reading. In an era when events linger in popular memory for increasingly smaller increments of time, Voices from the Underground serves us all by bringing back to life those rebel shouts and rants, as well as the thoughtful critiques and criticism that marked the 1960s and the 1970s oppositional press. Without a World Wide Web or Internet to connect and inform those who refused the official version of events, it fell to the intrepid youth of that period to create a lively media that unraveled lies, put forth a vision, and gave a clenched fist and a raised middle finger to power. Now, let me see. Who said
that? How eloquent. That is an eloquent statement.
That was me.
Oh, Peter, how do you like that?
Oh, do I have an ego?
Let me throw one other quote out while we're at it, though. An important project that information needs to be available. I liked the list of GI newspapers and was not aware there were so many. That was by Country Joe McDonald of Country Joe and the Fish. Real honor to hear his. We all know him as, 1, 2, 3, what are you fighting for? Yep. But he was a military man before he became anti-war. And even now, he's very close to the military families.
He does do that.
So, I sent him a couple articles and asked for the story and the quote, and he was mostly attracted to that list of underground papers from the military.
That's great. Ken Wachsberger, thanks for sharing time with us.
Thanks so much, Peter.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. You know, about 400 or 500 years ago, European colonialists got a good idea, they thought at least. They could take African people from Africa, bring them to the United States, work them for free, own them as property, and they would create this enormous amount of wealth, in fact, the foundation wealth of our country. Much like other white settler colonial states like the South Africa, Australia, a couple others as well. Well, it worked out in a way financially. The human toll, of course, was grotesque beyond belief. And the idea of importing African people to this country is part of a controversy, or has created controversy, created situations, problems for this nation that have never gone away, even 50 years after the civil rights movement. And we see it today in every aspect of life. Education is one of those. And here's a book that's come my way. It's called Stubborn Roots, Race, Culture, and Inequality in U.S. and South African Schools. It's written by Prudence L. Carter. And she's an associate professor of education and sociology at Stanford University. She's also co-director of the Stanford Center for Opportunity Policy and Education, which is SCOPE. And it looks at 8 schools located within 4 cities in the United States and South Africa, and deals with the fact that we have not come to grips with racial disparity. And we reach Prudence L. Carter. She is in her office in Palo Alto. Welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you for having me.
There's been any number of books on racial inequality and racial disparity in the United States. How did you decide to link it up with South Africa?
Well, the project started about almost 10 years ago when I visited South Africa for the first time. And I was visiting a couple of schools just as an exploratory event. I was there for the first time in South Africa as a tourist, but also as a researcher. I was a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Michigan, and I was sitting out on a plaza, a sunny day, with a group of kids who were a multiracial group of kids, and a number of them were African kids from a township, the segregated townships of this area, and I call it in the book Latisi. And I was talking to a young boy, and I said to him, what is it like for you to come across these neighborhood boundaries from your segregated township to this multiracial school daily? It was a very affluent school. He had different kinds of kids. And, you know, just years prior, he was in all segregated schools. And he said something to me that was very reminiscent at the time of things that I had heard in American schools and that I had written about in my prior book to this one. And that was it. Ma'am, you know, the kids back in the townships think that we're acting white. And then I found out from him and his peers that here in the school, we're often treated like we're the other. And so this young kid was dealing with the kind of tension between trying to be academically mobile, to get good access to good school resources, but also some of the cultural tensions that ensue when you become a part of the, quote, dominant class. And I was really startled by that, because we've used that explanation in the United States, that one reason why kids, particularly African American and Latino kids, are not doing as well is because they're, quote, resisting acting white.
That's
really what motivated the study, is trying to think about the tension between cultural and social and economic mobility.
What does it tell you that, I mean, I was kind of surprised that the same phraseology is used, 8,000 miles away. away from here. And it was articulated in exactly the same manner?
Articulated in exactly the same manner, but not meaning necessarily the same things. Here in the U.S., the popular media have appropriated the term acting white to signify that minority kids, when they say it, they're being anti-intellectual, that they are resisting the values of education. And that is actually not what I heard in South Africa. And it's actually, I argue in my first book, it's not really what kids mean in the United States either. But that's a whole other program. But in this case, what these kids were doing is that they were, one, the instant when they would go home, they would speak English instead of their native tongue. And they were actually prioritizing or privileging English first. And that was really hard for the kids back who were in the segregated township schools because, and that was part of it, you're speaking the language of the, quote, former oppressor. And, you know, this historically during the civil rights movement in South Africa, the anti-apartheid resistance movement, this was a big deal for students and educators. So that was the first thing. The other thing is that they were changing their cultural taste. They liked pizza as opposed to African pies. They were dressing and emulating the dress styles of their white peers. And so in many ways, it was like their cultural tastes were changing and they were different from the African kids who were still attending the segregated township schools. So it didn't mean anything, and it was absolutely not about just wanting to get a good education. It was more about you changing as a cultural animal.
Well, is it true? I sort of notice it in because most of my, when I say most of my social interactions, the gym I go to and all that are integrated. And there is like so many groups that haven't fully been assimilated into the dominant American culture. They have two ways of talking. I mean, there's when I see a bunch of African American guys at the gym, they're quote talking black or I don't even know if this is disparaging, you know, talking ghetto. And yet you start talking to them and they're doctors, they're you know, but the sports thing, it comes off like an entirely different way of you know, of language, if you will. So, but I mean, but it, maybe it's like Jews talking Yiddish and Italians talking Italian, trying to retain some unique ethnic identity. Does that make any sense?
Well, it makes sense, and it's actually, it really links nicely that comment to one of the main points of the book, and that is that we all have the capacity to be multicultural and to maintain multiple cultural competences. That's what we say as sociologists, as social scientists. And that, you know, one of the things that I argue and that I learned from this research is that children who can move more seamlessly across different cultural contexts are the ones who are thriving, the ones who can speak different languages, speak different vernaculars, who see themselves as multifaceted, can maintain, you know, we all embody multiple identities. We're all different in so many ways. But it's those people, you know, in the wider society, when we think about the middle and upper middle classes, we value cosmopolitanism. We value the worldly traveled person, the person who has knowledge about all aspects of society. And you can think about that in this vein, too. The kid who is culturally flexible, he can move from home to school to peer group to the workplace, or even those doctors and lawyers you were talking about who can move to the gym and back to their community and then to their workspaces. That's the process of negotiating multiculturalism. And it's something that all of us really, I suggest in this book, just based on the research of all of these children who are of color and white, those children who do that best are the ones who show the best, who are having the most positive educational experiences.
Well, Prudence L. Carter, I've kind of taken you off in a different direction. Let's get back more in your book, Stubborn Roots, Race, Culture, and Inequality in U.S. and South African Schools. It's published by Oxford University Press, and there'll be a link on my website, Peter Werbe, Werbe.com. So within the context of your book, what does this all mean? I mean, we still see, within the United States at least, African-American schools underperforming and young men and women coming out not, quote, prepared for modern work.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, this study, let me clarify, Peter, this is a study about the question about are resources enough or is the calculus about success and mobility through school greater than that? Is the formula greater than that? The schools in my study were both majority-minority schools, and they were also majority-white schools, and they were solidly performing schools. Many schools in this country, as you say, are many schools and many students, particularly African-American students and Latino students and Native American students, are not doing as well. And part of that is that we narrowly have defined schools as just a performance on the test score, success as a performance on the test score. But in this research, what we found is that even when we can put students in schools where there are a lot of resources, you know, there's a lot of money for the physical plant and the books and the smart boards, et cetera, if we do not attend to the sociocultural and sociopolitical aspects and components of schooling as well, if we do not figure out how to deeply engage kids, we're not going to be as successful as those schools that do. So the children who were African-American and Latino in my study, who were in schools where the teachers were very much attendant to trying to make sure that they were more deeply engaged, that they felt like they belong, that they could have an attachment to the schools, did significantly better and had better educational experiences than the students who were just like them in terms of racial and class backgrounds, who attended schools that while they had resources, the teachers just didn't feel that their teachers had enough respect for them, didn't care about who they were, and then certainly weren't attended to how their material realities and their identities played out in schooling on a day-to-day level.
You know, how much does class play in all this? Because in racialized America, and I suppose in South Africa as well, as soon as someone walks in a room, we identify them by their race. I mean, that's the first thing, boom, because, you know, skin color, uh-huh. That's the most obvious thing that, that presents itself. And yet, when you think of the underperforming schools that have minority students, they're always in poor districts. Even when I went to school, and I went to integrated schools, there was a group of kids from a sector of Detroit, African-American community, that were the doctors and the lawyers and the judges and what have you, and they actually had this nickname, I don't know if this is nationwide or just Detroit, called the Elites, in other words, the elite. And beneath them they were all in college-bound curriculums. Beneath them, there were black working-class kids that were the problem kids that didn't do well and what have you. So we always focus on race, where class is such a determinative factor.
I agree with you that class is a determinative factor. I don't think that we always focus on race. I think as you opened up, the point is that race and class are so inextricably linked. And disproportionately, when we see the depictions of those who are poor and who are not faring well, they are generally black and brown in this country. And the same is the case in South Africa. But that's a black dominant country. And what I'm trying to suggest here, this book, Seven Roots, is actually about both race and class. What's very interesting, though, is that even when we can control for class or when we can consider class and hold that and know that class matters, we see how race can manifest itself and still racial inequality, ethnic inequality can still manifest itself. And I don't try in this book in any way to kind of say the two are the same. And I think there is a tendency to want to make class or create the primacy of class inequality at the risk of ignoring that racial inequality still fundamentally exists in this country. If it were not the case, then we would have more deeply integrated schools. And that's just not a class story. That is a race story. And the reason why South Africa is an interesting comparative case, in the South African context, most of the integration process, and I should say desegregation because that's a different concept. Integration has yet to really be fully realized. But desegregation happens mainly among the middle class because they're unlike in the United States where you have to pay, you know, we pay tax assessments on our properties and those that provides a lot of the revenue. In the South African case, children's families have to pay an annual fee to go to public schools. It is the middle class who can afford to go to the better public schools that are much more diverse. And it's there that we see white families and black families and Asian or Indian families and colored families, which is another racial group there, that are middle class and lower middle class going to school together, and we still see the white population diminishing over time because of the interactions. So that signals to me that race is an autonomous kind of social process in and of itself, that it's not just about class. When you're in school with black and brown children whose parents are teachers and doctors and lawyers, and it's still not enough for you, you still feel like the school's not going to be a good school. And so over the course of my research, over a 5 to 6 year period, I saw a 10% decline in the white presence in these schools, which were actually high-performing schools. So, and it was attributed to the fact that the schools had changed in terms of their demographics. Now, bring it back to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
In this study, another way in which I understood how class matters is that the schools that I studied here, many of the African-American kids were on free and reduced lunch. Many of the Latino kids, these were poor and in many cases working-class kids. Half of the kids, actually, in one of my schools, most of the kids, were being bused into a very affluent white school. The other kids from that city were attending a majority-minority high school. The kids in the majority-minority high school were having and reporting significantly greater rates of what I call cultural flexibility, higher self-esteem. They were much more participatory in the school than the minority kids who were going to the majority white schools. They were all poor kids. And so it was signifying something when we say it's about having high quality schools. I argued in this book that resources, good resources and good teaching are absolutely required and necessary, but they're not sufficient, particularly if we don't pay attention to some of the more what we call symbolic and social psychological aspects of schooling. And the majority minority schools tended to be doing that. Now, mind you, there are many other we don't talk about minority schools as being high performing. The stereotype or the dominant image is that they're all bad performing. There are actually a lot of good minority schools out there. In fact, I'm in a product of one. And many of those schools, though, that you talk about, are suffering from resource deficits.
Sure.
They don't have a significant number of teachers who many a times there's a high turnover rate. They don't even, you know, in a former study of mine where many of the schools, the kids barely had chalk and the tatty buildings, leaky roofs. You know, these are not conditions in which we can adequately educate our children.
No, in Detroit, I mean, some of the classes are getting up towards 40 kids. I know teachers that have to buy supplies. Teacher, a friend of mine teaches in Detroit, had to bring toilet paper for the kids. You know, we always say the richest country in the world. My guest is Prudence L. Carter, and she has written Stubborn Roots, Race, Culture, and Inequality in U.S. and South African Schools, and she's an associate professor of education and sociology at Stanford University. And Stubborn Roots, that's what seems so difficult, because when you have, usually it seems to me when either in residential or in schools, when you start having a dominant majority-minority, in other words, you have that the whites, so-called, are in the minority, there's usually a strategy for getting out. I mean, the families do not like the situation. The idea that they are the minority group is not appealing. Did you find that still to be true? I mean, that's horrible after all these years, I'd say.
Well, it's one of the, and this is another argument about it. What was very interesting here in the study is that, you know, there is so much that we can try to do at the governmental level, at the governmental level, at the judicial level, to try to get our societies to promote and engender a very healthy democracy. To get people, to get us as citizens to diminish our boundaries and to be more cohesive. But the problem is that there is something stubborn in the habits and hearts of people on the ground, particularly when they're suspicious about the other, they don't know anything about the other. And I argue here in Stubborn Roots that segregation has fundamentally undermines the ability of any society to be fully and holistically a healthy democracy. And so it is the case. Now, in my study, one of the case study schools was actually a school were white students, actually two were schools where white students were in the minority. We do have some instances in this country where white families will commit to schools if the schools show high performance, if they have high turnover. One of my schools had a very strong AP
program, and it was actually considered one of the top 500 schools in the country. And there are some of those on the list, the U.S. News and World Report, where they are majority African American and or Latino, but white families see that they're also very good schools. So you do have some of those. I mean, mind you, they may be the exceptions. But for the most part, families are fleeing. And if they don't feel like the schools are going to be good and the test scores are going to be good. But part of that, I think, is just spurred by, and this is what the students tell me, this is what educators tell me, my research tells me, is so much of it is spurred by, one, our own residential segregation, and I know you have quite a bit of that in Detroit.
Sure.
And that residential segregation fuels and reproduces from generation to generation fundamental stereotypical adverse notions about the other. And if we can't minimize that, then I fear that we probably never will get to the schools that really are representative of America. Now, some communities have been good at doing that across the country. Most of our communities have not. We don't have very vibrant, diverse, and well-integrated communities in the country.
The book is Stubborn Roots, Race, Culture, and Inequality in U.S. and South African Schools. My guest is Professor Prudencel Carter. I think it was Henry Louis Gates recently said, or maybe I'm not sure exactly when it was, if it wasn't for the importation of Africans as slaves, we just would have had a country with competing European ethnic groups, competing for power and prestige and what have you. The insertion of this horrible institution of slavery has skewed everything in a way that makes it difficult. I mean, I do a phone-in talk show as well, and I usually when I get white callers to say stupid things, I say if you can't think straight about race, you can't think straight about anything else. It so perverts the capacity for critical thinking. Do you agree with that?
I think what I can say from my own students and from what I interactions I have moving through the world as a sociologist and teacher is that part of the problem is most of us don't know the history well. And what I try to tell briefly in the book, some of that history, my students are often surprised about how the middle class was built in American society, and they didn't realize that there were actual de jure policies, there were governmental policies that actually made it impossible for African Americans, for example, to get mortgages so that they could also live in middle class communities. And we could, there are so many different kinds of ways in which discrimination and segregation help to create and build wealth for the white middle class in this country, and then subsequently that was actually transmitted from generation to generation. And so once the civil rights movement and era came around and opportunities started to open up, we actually thought that the playing field was level. But the playing field was not quite leveled in many ways because wealth was being built, and wealth is a big component. It's not just enough for families to have the same kind of household income, but it's also what they can actually provide for their children, how they can pay for college educations. So I do think that part of the issue is that we actually don't know that history. And in terms of, I can't speak on Professor Gates's comment. I do know that there is a lot of status jockeying in our history. And because of the roles and the placement of African Americans, Native Americans, and even Asian ethnic groups of various sorts, it made it possible for white ethnics to cohere around the notion of whiteness because they did have groups that were presumed to be lower, and those were those of color.
Yeah, I think someone else once said, I don't remember who, that the biggest political party in this country is the party of resentment. And so whereas I think you see, we're getting close to the end of our conversation, is that you see finally a generation of young people that are comfortable with everyone and that they judge people on the basis of the kind of human being they are. It's in Martin Luther King's dream that he mentions in that speech. On the other hand, you still have this reservoir of people say, well, they have everything and they get this and they get that, that still there's this inability, and that's what I was talking about critical thinking, to understand why we have so many of the problems we do, not just with race, but with the economy and our standing in the world and everything else. So, I mean, that's like a 9-part question. I mean, maybe the most positive part of it is, I mean, aren't we finally seeing seeing some epochal change in people's attitudes, that it is about the quality of the person and not the color of their skin?
I would like to see that. I would like to believe that. Certainly our survey data would show. I mean, what people say, and I talk about this in Stubborn Roots as well, what we say we believe and the values that we hold and how we act in our day-to-day, how we live, how we make friends, where we worship, where our social civic organizations are, how we raise our kids, who we deem to be respectable enough to be their friends. Those kinds of day-to-day actions, though, can often belie the values that we say we espouse, that we hold.
So is that cynical?
There's a tendency to want to naturalize it and say that's just human behavior. I'm a sociologist, Peter, so I actually believe that's constructed. And what the children, there's a young man who was one of the respondents and participants in my study, and he said to me, Prudence, if we want to reduce the achievement gap in our society, we actually have to reduce the empathy gap. And what he meant is that the chasm between us as people, because of these different boundaries, I write about boundaries in this work, can be so palpable even on a day-to-day level. When I was in these schools in both countries, I could walk into the cafeteria and you could tell what the social geography of the school was just by looking at who was sitting where. It was quite segregated. Now, the kids, there's nothing malevolent about their interactions with one another, but they are not comfortable with one another. And where are they getting these ideas? We get them from our parents. We get them from the other adults in our lives. We model that which we are shown. And so I'd say, yes, we've come a long way since the Jim Crow era of the early 1900s and the 1940s and 50s, but we still have a ways to go if we want to really say that we live in a post-racial society. I do not believe we live in a post-racial society.
Nope.
And as long as we don't live in a post-racial society, we're also going to be fundamentally dealing with the class issues that we have, because the two are really inextricably linked in this country.
Well, I want to thank you so much for spending your time with us. My guest has been Professor Prudence L. Carter, Associate Professor of Education and Sociology at Stanford University. Her book, which is necessary for all of us that care about the future of our country, is Stubborn Roots, Race, Culture, and Inequality in U.S. and South African Schools. You can go to the Oxford University Press website at oup.com, or go to my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. Prudence Carter, thanks for being on my broadcast.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you for having me.